Support for Boston Public Radio comes from New England Recovery Center, providing inpatient addiction treatment in state-of-the-art facilities located in Westboro, Mass. All major insurance plans accepted. Learn more at newenglandrecoverycenter.org.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, another black man has been killed at the hands of police, and once again we're left asking, why did this have to happen? Rayshard Brooks was asleep in his car when officers woke him up, and after he resisted arrest, they killed him. The police chief has resigned, the cop has been fired. But does anyone think the outcome would have been the same had Brooks been white? In a few minutes, we'll open the lines to ask you.
We'll cover Governor Baker's coronavirus press conference at noon, and then protesters don't just want to defund police. They want to make sure they don't get a free ticket to ride, the MBTA, that is. After police clashed with protesters during a protest in Boston, protesters called out the T for not only shutting down T service and stranding protesters, but also for shuttling the cops to that protest. We'll get the whole story from our transportation guy, Chris Dempsey, when he joins us ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So did you hear the NPR news about the Supreme Court 6-3 decision?
Saying yes, I did.
Gay,
yes,
lesbian, and transgender employees are covered by Title VII. I am stunned. I mean, to say that it, would you agree that it's a function of the times and that it's not quite as likely that Roberts and Gorsuch would have been voting on the right side of history were it not the environment we're currently in?
Well, you also wonder, because many people have been extremely upset, including myself, about ultra-conservative and, in many cases, super unqualified justices that have been nominated to various courts by the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. You wonder whether rulings will be able to stand, given that those judges' opinions in many cases are so far out of the mainstream in the United States of America. It gives me some hope that their ability to turn back the hand. Well, I like to think, and you know, it's often true. It used to be true that once the judges actually got to a court, they all started moving to the left. Now, this may not be true of the ones Trump has appointed, but I think it's going to make it harder for them to do far out of the norm decisions because the country won't stand for it, I hope.
In any case, we'll talk more about that later in the day. But first, yesterday, in an interview with Fox News' Chris Wallace, Ben Carson said that the fatal shooting of Rayshard Brooks at the hands of a police officer was not a clear-cut case as to who bears responsibility for the deadly outcome.
We don't know what was in the mind of the officer. When somebody turns around and points a weapon at him, is he absolutely sure that that's a non-lethal weapon? You know, this is not a clear-cut circumstance.
Well, what we do know is that Rayshard Brooks was running away from police officers. We also know that a medical examiner has ruled Brooks' death a homicide, with the autopsy citing Brooks' cause of death as gunshot wounds to the back. So while the nation is still reeling from the murder of George Floyd, we are confronted with another example of white police officers, this time in Atlanta, using excessive force on blacks. We're opening the lines asking you if this is a sign that change will be a lot harder than just amending some laws, or does the death of Rayshard Brooks only further the protesters' cause and drive home the urgency of this crisis? And, you know, also, is it a time, Marjorie, for us to figure out other ways around someone who is passed out in a car in a fast food drive-thru, or someone who allegedly passed a counterfeit $20 bill? Should dialing, I guess, 911 be our last resort than our first impulse in lots of cases? And by the way, is there any doubt in your mind that if it was you or I who would pass out in that
happened.
Car,
that they would let me go?
Well, we sure as hell would not be dead.
Or they might have said, call a member of your family to come get you because you're not in a position to drive. You know what? I remember years ago when I was at the Boston Herald, there were police chases that were kind of de rigueur. They went on all over the country. Someone would flee. Rodney King, remember when he fled from the cops after a drunk driving thing, he led them on a police chase. You would have these things going on all over the country. And then a group of families got together whose loved ones had been run over and killed by the cops because the cops were, they, you know, were in
having
a police
nothing
chase
to do with the thing.
Yeah, they'd be on the highway, or
right,
they'd be
right,
pedestrians, or they began this nationwide thing. What? Just let them go. Let them go. Why do we have to chase them? Why do we have to go down the highway or down city streets at 70 miles an hour, down the highway at 90 miles an hour? It put a huge amount of pressure on police departments across the country to say, to reassess, let them go. And to me, that was the answer with this 27-year-old young man who, yes, he shouldn't have been drinking, obviously. Let him go. Let him go. What did they know about him? They knew that he had been drinking. He wasn't in the car anymore when he was running away and shot in the back. So it's kind of this, we got to get him, which is actually what one of the police officers said.
Reported to have said that is really important.
Yes.
We got
him. Just let him go. And I think that's one of the things that should come out of this, is you're not talking about a man who's got a two-year-old that he's abducting and threatening to murder in the car. It's somebody who had too much to drink.
Well, wait a second, but you don't think the cop in Atlanta knew that if a guy is running away and has not committed a violent crime and appears to have a taser, not a firearm, that he didn't know what you said already? I mean, he chose to shoot him.
I think that we have had this mantra coming out of the department for years, which is, well, the police officer feared for his life, just like we just heard the cabinet secretary say, Ben Carson. Well, he didn't know. He didn't know. He could have been.
How
in fear
did this
for
guy
his
fear
life.
For his I life? Who could make that case?
We just heard it from Ben Carson that.
His boss is Donald Trump.
But you hear this constantly. The person reached in his pocket. The officer was in fear for his life. The person turned around in the car was in fear for his life. Usually, of course, it's a black person that's doing the turning around or the reaching. It's not a 50-year-old middle-aged white woman. It's a black man or a black woman. That's their excuse. That has to change, too. And as I've said this repeatedly since the coronavirus happened, you know, when you become a police officer, you know you are going to a very dangerous job, and obviously nobody wants to be injured or killed on the job. But we saw all across America tens of thousands of nurses, nursing assistants, physicians, orderlies, minimum wage workers at hospitals going to take care of coronavirus patients when they were in fear for their lives. They didn't have any guns. They didn't have any weapons. We expected them to do it, didn't we? So why do we give this out to police officers that they are in fear for their life? If that is going to be something, if you are not willing to protect and serve, then you shouldn't be a police officer. And I think for too many years, the excuse has been, what could the officer do? He was in fear for his life.
Well, it seems to me, I feel about this exactly as I feel about corporate, some of the corporate criminals, Masters of the Universe from 2008. Law changes don't do it. Convictions do it. There have been far too few indictments and convictions of cops. And my guess is if Chauvin up there in the case of Floyd in Minneapolis or this guy in Atlanta are charged and convicted, it changes the dynamic. I'm not saying laws don't have to change, but mindsets have to change. And I think mindsets are changed when there's serious consequences for killing somebody as opposed to letting you off because you contend you were worried about your life.
The philosophy has to change too.
That's what I'm talking about.
In this kind of situation, it's clear to me, let them go. Let them go.
Well, that's not philosophy. That is policy, Marjorie. That's the policy almost everywhere. And they don't let them go because they make the contention. The exception to the policy is I was reasonably in fear for my life. And what I assume this guy was not aware of or didn't think about is it's pretty hard to make that argument when there's a camera that shows you're shooting a guy in the back.
Back, that's right, as he was fleeing.
Twice.
And we've seen this before, haven't we?
We have indeed. 877.
When people are fleeing and they're shot in the back.
301-8970. We just want your thoughts on how this changes the dynamic. If it does, what your reaction was to yet another incredibly horrible video. Let's start with Bernier in Hyde Park. Bernier, thanks for calling as always. Hi.
Hi, good morning, and welcome back, Marjorie.
Thank you.
I this is so discouraging, really. It's like I can't even watch those things. When I see them, I'm trembling. I'm traumatized. I feel like we all need therapy. But there's a sliver of hope amongst this chaos. The sliver of hope that I see is, I remember 2 weeks ago I called and I said that I was thinking of ideas that could change things. I said I was going to write them down and email them to you. Primarily, what I started writing, and I honestly stopped because I saw that things were going people were doing exactly what I said needed to be done. I've always thought that the police themselves are just a tool that the society has to persecute black people. The real culprits, I've always said, is the politicians. Because think about it. In New York, you hear Cuomo saying that he's going to do A, B, C, D. Mayor Waltz is doing things. City Council in Minneapolis are doing things. What does that mean? That means that the politicians are the ones that are doing things. And they could have done things in the past. And the reason why they didn't do it is because they were cowards. Now that they see that the public is rising up, they grow the testicular fortitude to do things.
That's exactly right.
I think people should focus on the politicians, not the police. The police are just a tool. Not that I'm not saying that the police are not guilty, but the police is just, you know, it's easy to blame the police. But the police always respond to what the politicians tell them to do.
But what do you mean, Ray? What do you mean, Brunier, focus on the politicians? What does that mean?
Okay. What I'm trying to say is that, say, arresting such and such police person because they did something, of course, that should be done. They need to pay the price, whatever they do. To have fundamental change, we need to put the feet of the politicians to the fire always. City councilor, every town manager, every mayor, every governor, so that they should reform the police departments because they're in charge.
Well, isn't that what's happening right now, don't you think? I mean, the question is,
that's why I'm fit. That's
how real is this going to be? And is there going to be teeth in anything? I mean, for example, I don't know if you heard Cuomo last night and talking about his commission that's going to meet for 9 months and it's going to talk to everybody and examine things, whatever. And the question is a nine-month commission a time-buying exercise or is it a real serious effort to get to the problem? I worry that a lot of these polls are trying to sort of do a CYA thing to just get through this period. The good news is it doesn't appear that the period is about to end. So hopefully the pressure will continue. But I guess, Brunier, what I'm also saying is even if you keep the politicians' proverbial feet to the fire, it's what Marjorie and I were talking about a minute ago, you can change laws. There's got to be a cultural, a philosophical change as well, which I think has to be imposed by society. I mean, it's sort of like what I was saying about the Supreme Court decision. I think this Supreme Court decision was in great part a function because America is rising up in terms of equality. With all due respect to Gorsuch and Roberts, I'm not a 6-3 decision protecting gays, lesbians, and trans people at their workplace, I think, is a function of us, people out in the world, not a function of law books. But, you know, I hear you, and clearly that's got to be part of the mix. They do have to feel the pressure. Brunier, thank you for the call, as always. 877-301-8970.
There's this constant refrain from politicians about, you know, the first responders, and I get it, particularly with firefighters, they're running into buildings that everybody runs out of. But, you know, there are other first responders, like social workers. We never hear that sort of adulation of social workers who are going into really volatile situations where children are being possibly abused. Why aren't they in that list of, why is their union always begging for reasonable accommodation for social workers? It's a male thing about cops. And I think that's, there's this, you know, and also the militarization. There was another story I just read this morning or yesterday documenting how the Pentagon has been pouring all these anti-grenade tanks and all these super-duper war materials to police officers that we didn't use in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's got to stop, too. They're not part of the military. And the wearing of all this high-tech gear with the riot gear all the time and all these things over their faces and things over their bodies. Yeah, I get it. They don't want to get shot. But on the other hand, they've changed from their purpose, it seems to me, of the protect and serve, and they've become these warriors. And I think there's the link between, you know, the cops want to get their endorsement. I mean, the politicians want to get the cops' endorsement. In Massachusetts, the governor wants to get the endorsement from the state police. In their cities and towns, they want to get endorsed by their local police. And with all due respect, thing, I think it's a macho thing going on there.
By the way, I want to make a correction. I was confusing Cuomo and Walsh. It is Mayor Walsh that announced the commission. Wayne Budd, former U.S. attorney, is going to be heading that up. And again, if this is a serious effort, Mayor Walsh is with us next Friday. We'll talk to him about it. That's one thing. If it's a time buyer, in the legislature, as we know, things are sent to committee in an attempt to kill him. I hope that's not the case here. Dave in Yarmouth, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Dave.
Hi. Hi, good morning. Hi. Margaret, I guess my question would be to you is, what can a police officer do to defend themselves? Doctors and nurses did go into the COVID thing, but they had an ability to defend themselves. We heard a lot about PPEs and their need for them, and we got them now. So police officers are allowed to defend themselves because at the end of the day, what are we asking police officers to do? We're asking them to maintain order and civil whatever, and we're asking them to do these things. Now, if you're saying that we should let people go if they don't want to be arrested, that's a different matter. That's what Eric Garner, that's what happened to him. If he had submitted to arrest, he'd be still alive today. He shouldn't have been killed, but that's what happened.
Well, hold on for a second, Dave. We didn't give PPP to all these nurses and doctors and physicians. Didn't you read all the stories about how they didn't have them and had to go in anyway? And then hundreds, if not thousands, of them, they didn't have the equipment and they went in anyway.
They didn't have the level of equipment they thought they needed, but the police officers probably think the same thing. So I'm asking you again, Marjorie, what level of defense as a police officer should be allowed?
I can answer the question. It's exactly what you said before.
Dave,
if they think their own life is at risk.
Well, no.
Why?
Because they always say that. They think what the line is always, Dave, are you a police officer, by the way?
I am not. No, I am not.
Okay, because what you always hear is what police officers say. It's been a problematic because now people are taking pictures and videos from their cell phones of it. But police officers say, and you know this, Dave, over and over again, the person, and it's often a black person, reached into his pocket. I was in fear for my life. The person turned around and went for something in the car. I was in fear for my life. You hear them say that all the time when the fact the person was going for their wallet or they had a cell phone. The
but Marjorie, you're not saying,
boy.
Marjorie, if they are legitimately in fear for their life, they should respond. The issue is, are they or aren't they? You're not saying they can't respond in any circumstance.
Jim, but these are not situations where a person has a AK-47 aimed at them. These are situations where the cops shoot
too quickly. Right, it depends on the facts. Obviously, it depends on the facts.
Well, when was the last, I mean, let's talk about the last shooting where someone was...
If a cop is aiming a gun at you... A gun
if
at you.
If a person's aiming a gun at you.
Yeah, then yeah, you don't think the cop has a right to defend themselves?
Well, which of these people was doing that?
No,
which of these young black men was doing
that? I'm not talking, obviously, about Floyd and Brooks. There are circumstances in which cops are legitimately defending themselves. In many cases, they are not.
But I can't think of any at the moment. Can you, Dave, think of someone where a defendant or a person that was under arrest had a major weapon that was aiming it at the cop? I can down it. Actually, there was one on the Cape.
There are tons of them,
there was
them,
one
actually.
In the Cape where that police officer was killed.
The young officer got killed in Yarmouth by the
That's a good... That is true. That is
so
absolutely true.
Cops and do die, Marjorie. Cops do
they
have
do.
To
happen. Dave,
they,
thanks for
they
the call.
They do, but...
You know, the issue... Marjorie, this is a fact determination. There
right.
are obviously circumstances in which a
Jim,
police officer reasonably believes that he or she is at risk.
But what we are talking about unarmed young black men for the most part. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about...
Well, obviously, in those cases, there's no defense.
Exactly. I mean, I'm not saying that if someone goes into a home and there's someone there with a... AK-47 pointed at them, the police officer doesn't have a chance to defend
himself.
Well,
I got to be clear here. If Brooks last night had not had a taser, but had taken the officer's gun and had turned around and faced him as pointing it at him,
that
you would,
exactly, would be different.
Right, but that isn't what happened. So it always depends on the fact pattern. Where your point is, with which I'm in total agreement, I think most of America is, that is the go-to defense for far too many police officers when they shoot people who don't merit being shot or killed. There's no question
Correct.
About that. Okay. That's correct. Take a break.
And we had the police officer shot in the face in Boston. And you know something? That police officer did recover. It was a terrible situation. But the Boston police arrested that man after he shot a police officer in the face. Right? He was arrested. And anyway, 617-822-1969 is the number. We're going to keep talking about this. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browning and Marjorie Egan. We're talking about the latest example of police using excessive force, fatally shooting Rayshard Brooks. You've seen the video probably more times than you'd ever like to. This is in Atlanta the other night. Our number is 877-301-8970.
I just wanted to mention when I was talking before about the officer that was shot in the face in Boston, that was John Moynihan. And
right.
The gunman in that case was legitimately shot at by police, and he was killed. But he shot John Moynihan in the face. So it was obviously a gun kind of situation.
Right. I just want to be clear here because it's a fact determination. With the point I think you're trying to make is that far too often a cop says that he or she felt his life was at risk when the evidence clearly suggests it was not. I mean, that mm-hmm. and those are the circumstances that obviously have to change, and there are far too many. Chris in a car, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
Hey.
I've retired about a year ago, but I've worked in law enforcement and corrections for a very long time.
Uh-huh.
To start with, I think you guys you really have to look at the training. Our training requires, we are trained to stop threat. We're not trained to kill anybody, we're trained to stop them. And with the last case that happened last night, he turned and pointed a taser at a police officer. The taser mm-hmm. itself is not lethal. It's what could happen after he shot with the taser. The person could go over and just take his gun. That's what
he was running away. Hey, excuse me, Chris. He was running away. Chris, he was running away from the guy with the gun, not running towards the guy with the gun.
At the moment, these guys have to think it in split second. He turned and he pointed the taser at the police officer. That's when he got shot. And as far as just letting
Chris, that is not true. When he pointed the taser, he was half facing the police officers. The autopsy suggests he was shot both two times
in the back
when he had turned around fully to run away. And by the way, Chris, I have none of your training, but if all of a sudden, as you suggest, after shooting the taser, Mr. Brooks turned around and started running at the cop directly, then you might have a different argument to make. He was running away from the police officer. I mean, I don't think it could be any clearer. And his weapon, in quotes, was something considered a non-lethal weapon, I think in virtually all of America, and at least in Georgia, a taser, which he had already shot. So what's the training that would suggest that he deserved to die?
In our training, as far as that being a non-lethal weapon, it is.
Yeah.
Until a bad person gets it. Now it's a lethal weapon. That's how we're trained. And well, Andrea could tell you better than anybody about
We'll ask her. We are trained to do that.
But
I just wanted to say one other thing.
Sure.
Marjorie, you had brought up, why didn't we just let him go?
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Let him walk home. We'll tow his car. You can't do that. Because what's going to happen, and it happens more times than not, is the bad guy goes back and gets his car still drunk. He doesn't want to leave it there. And then he goes and hits somebody. And as far
but Chris,
as being,
I think we're getting away.
Guy.
I think we're getting away from the major argument here, which is if this were me, a middle-aged white woman, I don't think I'd be dead. I think that's the difference here.
And, but can I also respond to Chris's last point, Marjorie, if I can? When you said he was running away, so just let him go. I don't mean, I assume Marjorie didn't either. Let him go. Go back into Wendy's if you're a cop and order a cheeseburger. On your radio, describe him. Say there is a man running away in a certain direction and create some sort of perimeter and grab the guy. No one is suggesting that the guy go away scot-free and not serve any penalty for what he did. What we are suggesting is he didn't deserve to die based on the objective circumstances. Chris, thank you much for your call. We appreciate your joining us.
And by the way, you know, when we talked about the police chase, you'd hear the same arguments. Well, you have to get them. You have to. Who knows what he's going to do? Who knows what he's going to do? But the argument from the other side was, well, speculating about what he might do down the road is not worth the four people that he killed when he was going down the highway at 90 miles an hour. And I guess that's the same thing. This guy was not abducting a child. He was not a murderer, a rapist. As far as the police knew, he was a guy that had too much to drink and shouldn't have been driving and fell asleep in the drive-thru. That's what he was. And again, we don't want to get away from the race argument. I don't think that would have happened to me.
I'm quite sure it wouldn't have happened to you. By the way, you know, you joke all the time about my run-in with that state cop on Morrissey Boulevard, where we're screaming at each other. I am not exactly the bravest guy ever. I was convinced he was going to arrest me. There was never a nanosecond in which I thought I was at physical risk. And unlike a woman, as you described, man, I'm a big guy. It's not as clear that I'm about as untough as it gets, but people don't know that from my appearance. But it's a totally different experience.
Everybody
I wouldn't have died in the Wendy parking lot, and you wouldn't have died in the Wendy parking lot. I mean, it's so obvious. Let's go to Karen in New Hampshire. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling, Karen.
Hi. First, let me just respond to that previous caller with shame on whoever the impound unit is that lets a drunk person take their car back. You can't let that happen.
But the reason
I was calling in is because some years back, my brother was a city councilor in a big city in Massachusetts, and they got a grant for community policing. They opened small units in lower income and difficult communities. People got to know the police officers. Crime dropped. It was an amazing thing to see. It was so beneficial, but the grant ran out and they could not sustain it. We need to get back to police in the communities. These are, like you said, militia men who are going out into areas where they don't know. They're afraid. They don't know the community. They don't know the people, and the people don't know them and don't support them. We need to get back to where our police are out on the streets and are aware of their surroundings.
By the way, you know, Karen, you've probably heard the last few days, and even though I'm from Philadelphia, I had forgotten this. When people are talking about defunding the police, virtually all the time they're talking about reallocating money, not literally defunding. There are two places I'm sure you've learned if you didn't know before. I didn't. Compton in California and Camden, where they did it. Camden, where they did do it, the reconstituted police force was laser-like focused on community policing. And I can't remember the precise number, but the crime rate went down there somewhere in the neighborhood of 41% to 42%. Yet further evidence of your point that community policing works. So, Karen, thank you much for your call. We appreciate it.
I want to read some of the email. This is from Paul,
please,
who says he did not deserve to die. If they let him go, there would be a drunk, angry guy with a taser out and about. Gwen says he would go back the next day, sobered up, and get his car. Corey says, I saw this quote the other day. It resonated with me, and here it is. We live in a world where trained cops can panic and act on impulse, but untrained civilians must remain calm with a gun in their face, which is a very good point. Leela from Brookline, thank you for calling.
We gotta go. Okay, we can take one more quick one. Hi, Leela.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I just want to say that the UNLEADER has benefited us with a history lesson that we never got in school, because there are several things I never heard about. Tulsa. And I know that there was a community that was ravaged by white people in Florida. Can't think of the name of it. And then we put the Japanese in prison for numbers of years because they were Japanese. And I never got that in school. So maybe we just need to start
Japanese Americans, by the way.
Absolutely.
Leela, good point. And Marjorie, so, before we break, thank you for the call.
Yeah.
Tell the story from 60 Minutes you were talking to me, but
was,
I didn't see it
last
night.
Interesting. One of my themes is that how embarrassing it is that I don't know any of this stuff, and I was an American Studies major. Well, I felt less like an idiot last night watching 60 Minutes. It was talking about that very attack in Tulsa where the cops, the National Guard, and white mobs basically burned down and this entire city, community of very well-to-do African Americans. They had their own, they were a very established community. And anyway, the reporter from 60 Minutes went to a community meeting of Tulsa residents at the end of the presentation, and this young man got up who looked like he was about 35. He was from Tulsa. He was African American, and he said, he never learned about it in school either, and he went to school in Tulsa. So the point of this is, as our attorney general unfortunately put it the other day, history is written by the winners, and a lot of the atrocities committed against those who are oppressed in America are not recorded in the history books. Anyway, coming up, we're talking about all things transit with Chris Dempsey, our transportation guy. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Does a return to normal mean a return to Boston's notorious traffic jams, particularly if commuters decide that driving their car is safer than using public transportation? Join us online for his take on what the reopening of the economy means for traffic. And other transportation headlines is self-declared transit nerd Chris Dempsey. Chris is the Director of Transportation for Massachusetts and former Assistant Secretary of Transportation. Chris, great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
To be on with you.
Well, Chris, I must say I have been enjoying driving from Cleveland Circle to South Boston in 15 minutes in rush hour these last few weeks. And normally it takes you like 45 minutes and driving to the Cape in like an hour and 20 minutes. But the party is, if not quite over, it's getting worse every day. A lot of traffic going to the Cape this weekend, Chris. It's over, isn't it? We're back to
the traffic
quite as bad,
is coming
but close.
Back, Marjorie.
Yeah,
so and I was guilty of it, too. I was driving this past week and this weekend, and you just see the sheer number of cars getting back on the road. People are getting back to work. People are deciding that it's time for them to go shopping or to start having some events or some social activity, and that just brings the traffic right back. And we are at risk, if we don't take action, of just going right back to being the most congested region in the entire country, which we've been named for now 2 years in a row.
So what action should we take? Charlie Baker rarely misses an opportunity at one of these coronavirus things. And by the way, we're going to be carrying it live at about 12 o'clock today's to say it's great that so many companies are allowing or encouraging their employees to work from home, which obviously reduces traffic. In addition to that, what should we be doing?
Well, we've had action in the Massachusetts House. That happened actually like the week before everything started to shut down. And we've got a great transportation bill now stuck in the Senate. And so we need action from the Massachusetts State Senate to get a bill onto the governor's desk that we hope he will sign sometime in the next 6 weeks, because we're only 6 weeks away from the end of the legislative session. That would be a really good place to start.
What would it do? What are the highlights that are relevant to what Marjorie asked you about, Chris Dempsey?
Well, so I'd point to two things. One is it raises new revenue to invest in our transportation system broadly, including in transit. And this is a critical time for the MBTA. We cannot abandon the MBTA despite the drop in ridership. We need to continue to support that organization because Massachusetts only works when our transit agency works. And then the other thing, which is more of a long-term conversation, but one that is going to be critical to actually solve the congestion problem, is that the House bill would create a commission on roadway and congestion pricing. You know, that's been a goal of mine for many years now, And this would be the next step. It wouldn't actually impose it, but it would just create a commission to study it. I'm not normally a big study guy, but in this case, I think we need to have that broader civic conversation. And so creating a commission is appropriate.
But Chris, before we leave this for a second, of the two elements you talked about, both of which I think are good ideas, the revenue raising is probably going to be put on the back burner for economic reasons currently. And the commission, even if it does wonderful work, is not going to come out with a report imminently. And by the time they return to revenue raising, and by the time the commission comes out with its recommendations, we're going to be practically back to the nightmare on the roads that we were before. What are there immediate things that can and should be done that cities can be doing, or we just crossing our fingers and hoping that a lot of people keep working at home?
No, I think there are. Look, it is true that work from home is going to be a part of the equation here. I think the other really important and critical thing is that we restore confidence that the MBTA is safe and that people are not putting their lives or their health at risk when they step onto a subway car or into a bus.
How do you do that?
That anxiety that people have is very real right now. So the MBTA is actually a national leader on keeping its vehicles clean right now.
Oh, really?
They're not doing a good enough job of telling the story about that. And we've been encouraging them to just do a better job of communicating, have more messages in stations, do more press conferences with Steve Poftak and Secretary Pollack saying we're a national leader on this. And I'll tell you what, I hate to say it, but this is true. And I know he's a regular guest on your show. At some point, we're going to need to see Governor Baker riding the MBTA, because he has earned so much credibility through the COVID-19 crisis as a person who is trying to manage it, has good information, you know, and it's such contrast to the federal and national situation. Mm-hmm. He's earned that. He needs to spend a little bit of that political capital, ride the system himself, and say, this is safe for me, it's safe for my family, it's safe for your family too.
So will people have to wear masks on the MBTA?
Yeah, so that's the requirement right now, and that's been in place for about a couple months already.
Okay.
Smart decision by the MBTA to do that. And, you know, I am not an epidemiologist, but the evidence seems to point to mask wearing as a really important way to stop these disease vectors. And there's really, actually, Marjorie, it will surprise you, but not a lot of evidence yet that transit has been a place where a lot of transmission has occurred. Even in places like Japan or South Korea or even places in Europe that have that density, have a lot of transit ridership, there's no evidence that it was the transit systems that created that. And so if people wear masks and the MBTA continues its nation-leading cleaning regimen, it should be pretty safe for people.
What about, I don't understand why in rush hour, places where it's really heavy traffic, why there isn't some enforcement that you can't smash in like sardines or whatever the expression is.
I mean,
is.
A capacity, you know, limit, I mean? Kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah,
I mean, they don't want to do that.
Yeah, no,
and I don't get it.
So, you know, it's really funny, right? Because you hear Governor Baker and others talk about how they want to really manage the T. They want to focus on the management of the T and get all the details right. He's really a details guy, right? He wants to roll up his sleeves. But then on the roadside, for 100 years now, basically, we've just let roads be a free-for-all. I mean, we never talk about managing our roads, right? You hear about the highway division building roads and maintaining roads, but never actually operating and managing them. And the next time you have Secretary Pollack on, you should ask her about this, because I know she cares about this issue. We need to be focused on management of our roads in exactly the same way we focused on managing the MBTA. They are a system, and those systems can work better. It's everything from the grand vision of something like congestion pricing down to things like how do we manage and coordinate stoplights or stop signals so that the flow works better, that we're giving people a better, more reliable trip. All of those things are possible if we focus on management and not just construction and maintenance.
So you think we should be limiting the numbers of people on the trains at rush hour?
Well, I'm sorry. I thought for some reason I thought you were talking about the roads, Marjorie. On the trains.
Yeah. Because that would make me feel better if I wasn't like shoulder to shoulder with someone having to ride into work every day. And on my favorite podcast this morning, I thought this was kind of a wacky idea, but the guy was talking about the New York City subways, that since most transmission of the virus occurs inside, that they should open the windows on the subway, as Jim thought that was a gross suggestion because it's so dirty and grimy down there.
Because the tunnels are disgusting. That's why.
I rode them
for 20 years.
Yeah. I don't know about on subways, but I do think on buses it can make sense. So here's, here's how we think about the hard cap or the limit on ridership. We're not supportive. My organization is not supportive of a hard cap on ridership. We do think that it makes sense that as the numbers of riders on a vehicle increase, that the MBTA sends out a warning to its operations team and says, hey, we're getting to a limit, it's starting to get uncomfortable here. Let's add more service. Let's add more trains. Let's add more buses. And let's give people the option through better information of maybe waiting for that bus to go by so they can get the next one. But I really worry about a hard cap because, and you've seen the images from a few weeks ago of people riding the Silver Line 3 bus in Chelsea and East Boston. You know, those are folks that are trying to get to work. And if they get left aside because the bus is too full, they might have to wait for 20, 30, 40 minutes for the next bus to come. And we don't want to see a situation where they're now late for work, their job is now at risk, even though they were doing the right thing by showing up on time. And so I think a hard cap is not wise, but a soft cap that says as soon as we start to get to a busy vehicle, we add more service is the right way for the T to approach it. And that's what they've been doing so far.
You know, one of the press conferences of the governor we carried last week or something, they talked about this $5 million grant to, I think, primarily help restaurants expand on the sidewalks, potentially streets, that kind of thing. The concept appeared to me to be great. The amount of money appeared to be modest. What exactly are these grants for? I think they're from $5,000 to $300,000. And how positive do you feel about them, if at all?
Yeah, I think this is a great idea, Jim. So this is an example where the Baker administration has kind of jumped in quickly and said, we know that our cities and towns across the state need to make some of these changes. They want to help small businesses. They want to create more space for pedestrians and cyclists who are now getting outside for fresh air a little bit more. And frankly, Jim, you know, the cost of these projects doesn't need to be very high. Did you see the images over the weekend of the North End with some of the restaurant space that was now on Hanover Street and even some of the side streets in the North End?
No.
Amazing photos. They're worth seeing. Your listeners should check them out. Places that used to just be parking and cars and are now open air dining. And they're really allowing these restaurants to reopen and these businesses, small businesses, to try to get restarted and keep people at work, which is a great thing. All it takes to do that, Jim, is a couple of cones and what we call like a hobby horse just at the end of the street that kind of blocks cars from going on that street. That's all it takes. This is thousands of dollars, not tens of thousands of dollars of equipment and employee time to set these up. And all of a sudden you're creating this wonderful space for diners and for restaurants, or again, for pedestrians and cyclists. So even though $5,000 might not seem like much, if that allows the city of Newton to close down a few streets and make them open for small restaurants, or if it allows Somerville to continue its shared streets program where people can now traverse Somerville without having to deal with auto traffic, that's a big win and a great opportunity for those cities and towns.
You know, we're talking to Chris Dempsey. I don't know if you've seen the piece. This slightly changed gears. It's still a transportation issue. As there's discussion of defunding or reallocating of police dollars, there have been some really interesting pieces written about places where police currently run the show and whether or not they need to. And Marjorie and I were reading this piece about whether or not most traffic enforcement needs to be done by a police. Would it not be done just as well by cameras? I'm not a big camera guy, but obviously there's no discrimination with a camera. And maybe some DUI force with some de-escalation training would be the bulk of what police and traffic enforcement do. It seems to be a pretty radical idea, but at the same time, when I thought about it, it seems to fit the moment's needs. Do you agree with that or no?
Yeah, and Jim, I heard some of your earlier discussion this morning about the tragic incident in Atlanta where folks that look like you and I and Marjorie, you know, we don't have that same problem where we're in fear for our life if we get pulled over by a police officer. And unfortunately, too many people of color do because of those experiences. And so I think there is a recognition here that there are times when we need to decriminalize or de-enforce some of these smaller issues that become sometimes more quality of life or smaller safety issues, but don't rise to the threat of needing an armed officer who is going to show up for the incident. I'm a big supporter of automated enforcement cameras. There are 13 states around the country that do it. And really? I'm sure you have your reservations, Jim. There are obviously some questions around the civil liberties issues here. But when you design these programs in the right way, they can improve safety and reduce crashes. The NTSB found that they can reduce crashes from anywhere from 8% all the way up to 40%. And if you set them up so that they're spread equally across neighborhoods and not targeting particular neighborhoods, and then you have rules in place like maximum fine amounts and even saying, look, the fines are not going to go to the city and town and where they're set up. They're just going to go to a general pool. So you don't have one city or town right. that's trying to right. balance their budget with this. They can really improve safety for everyone. And another important perspective here is that when we look at who is harmed by people that run red lights or run stop signs, pedestrians and cyclists are the folks, that, of course, that bear the biggest brunt of that because they're the ones that get hit and they get sent to the hospital and they die. And walking while black is a real thing in this country. If you are a black person in the U.S. and you're a pedestrian, you are twice as likely to be hit by a vehicle than if you're a white person. Now, that's not because the drivers are intentionally trying to hit people of color. It's because there are too many neighborhoods throughout the country where we have not invested in safe pedestrian infrastructure or safe cycling infrastructure. Those tend to be, in many cases, lower-income communities. And so it's the folks that are in those communities that are the ones that are bearing the brunt from our inability to enforce these basic laws.
Now, Chris Dempsey, I just have to interject here to say that Jim is giving a disingenuous story about why he doesn't like cameras. It's because he wants to slither around town undetected, and he's worried that he won't be able to continue doing that.
By the way, I'm actually willing to reconsider this in the current moment. But do you not worry about cameras taking pictures of you every 3 seconds, Marty, wherever you go?
That happened to me many times when I went through the Mass Pike before they had the... They took pictures
of
my
license
plate.
Oh, right, when you forgot to pay your tolls and your speeding.
Yeah, you had to get
whatever.
I think the cameras are a great idea. I mean, I don't want to get pulled over either.
The way they
work now is they only go off when there is an infraction. So they're not constantly recording. They're just monitoring. And if they
see someone
go through a red light, that's when they snap the photo.
You know, before we get back to policy, you know, I just realized I was checking out your Twitter feed. And everybody knows, Chris Dempsey, your dream in life is to drive a city bus. And someday we all hope to be able to see you do this. But you came as about as close as you could to realize, well, a variation on the theme. Tell the story about you and the bus driver the other day at the time of a demonstration in Brookline Village.
Yes.
Yeah, so this was the highlight of my month and maybe the highlight of my year so far. I live right on Washington Street in Brookline Village, and that's where the Brookline Black Lives Matter protest was occurring, right in front of Town Hall and the police department, which are across the street from each other. And I walked out of my apartment to go participate in the protest and just be a part of it because it was a really important moment for my community. I walk out the door and the 65 bus, which goes from Kenmore Square to Brighton Center, is stuck on Washington Street and it can't get around the protest. The protest has taken over the entire street. The driver is there sort of frustrated saying like, what the heck am I going to do? And I walk up to her window's open and I say, hey, do you need a little bit of help?
You're unbelievable.
And she says, yeah, I don't know what the heck I'm doing here. So she let me jump on board. These are the streets that I grew up on in Brookline Village. I mean, literally, we went around my elementary school. We went on Holden Street, took a right on Pierce Street, a left on Harvard, left on school, and that got us right back onto Washington Street. It was a really fun moment. She was good-natured about the whole thing. She wanted to get people to the end of their line without too much disruption. So a really fun moment for me and hopefully one that worked out well.
Listen to the pride in his voice, Marjorie. Can you hear it in his voice?
That's great.
Unbelievable.
The
it's great.
Back roads of Brookline Village.
The
Who
mean streets.
We made it to Brookline
Village.
That's right. I used to live on Linden Street, Chris, so there we were almost neighbors.
No, we went right by Linden. We went right by Linden on our way.
That's right, Linden. That's a wonderful street. Wonderful street.
It is.
Okay, so let's move on here. Let's talk about this story that details how people of color are so much more likely to live in neighborhoods with heavy pollution. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is really terrific work from the Metropolitan Area Planning Council, which is a close partner of ours. And what they did is they looked at air pollution from major roads and highways throughout Greater Boston. And they found that, maybe not surprisingly, it's disproportionately people of color who breathe in that really bad air that comes from those highways. I think this is a teachable moment, and Marjorie, you'll appreciate this as a history major. When people when people talk about structural racism, you know, I think sometimes you sort of scratch your head and you say, well, what does that mean? How does that really work? Highways in major cities are a great example of structural racism compounding over decades and generations. Because it turns out that in the 1930s and 40s, when we were designing the locations of these roads, we sent them through redlined areas, yeah. areas that the federal government had said should be slated for disinvestment or were declining in terms of their status. And those were often communities of color. You look at places like Chelsea or Roxbury or Chinatown that fit that category in those red lines.
Yep.
So we knocked down homes, we knocked down businesses, which disincentivized investment in those places. We ran highways through them, but then in many cases, those communities of color stayed there, and they're now breathing in that air for the third or fourth generation. That leads to higher rates of asthma, of heart disease, of cardiovascular disease, all sorts of health ailments and issues, many of which we've seen are now correlated with people having severe cases of COVID-19
exactly.
when they catch it. It's a great example of how past policy decisions and racism, frankly, of generations ago now lives with us today. And it's when people talk about being anti-racist or deconstructing some of those institutions, they're not saying, you know, hey, just turn society upside down. They're saying there is a real legacy here that needs to be addressed. And so groups like Transportation for Massachusetts try to partner with others, community-based groups, to say, how can we reduce pollution on those roads, give people cleaner air, and maybe even give them better access to jobs at the same time?
We're out of time. Let's continue
Chris,
that conversation next time you're here, Chris. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks so much, Chris. Chris Dempsey is Director of Transportation for Massachusetts and former Assistant Secretary of Transportation. Governor Baker's coronavirus press conference is up next on 89.7 WGBH.
In a couple of minutes, we'll take Governor Baker's daily press conference live. Then, as protesters call to defund the police, the question arises, do we really need cops to enforce traffic laws? How about a DUI force with de-escalation training? More cameras, and that's it. In a few minutes, we'll ask Chris Dempsey.
After living as a soccer hooligan in the United Kingdom, journalist Bill Buford hung up the cleats and bought a chef's knife. In his new book, Dirt, Buford explores the roots of another great European tradition, French cuisine, and he doesn't take his task lightly. Replete with in-depth explorations of the science behind bread, cheese, and all things buttery, Buford tells of the toll of working in the chef's greatest kitchens and the toll it takes on even the toughest folks. Bill Buford joins us to tell more up ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. So any minute, well, we always say any minute, and it's never any minute, but soon, it's often not soon either, sometime in the next few minutes, the 12 o'clock press conference, the almost daily coronavirus press conference of Governor Baker, this one I think is at the State House, will be called to order. We'll bring it to you live. In the interim, it is exactly a week, Marjorie, since phase two
yep.
began here in Massachusetts. Outdoor restaurants, we know, well, everybody knows. I remember I was waiting with bated breath for what was going to be open, what you could do. And we figured we'd spend the few minutes leading up to the governor's press conference asking you, in the 7 days since the phase two began, if you're a business owner, how has it gone for you? Whether you own a restaurant, a hair salon, whatever it is. And if you're a consumer, how much have you ventured out in the world in the 7 days since phase two began. Our number is 877-301-8970. Now, you've done the restaurant thing twice in 1 week. Am I not right, eating outside? Is that not true?
I only did it once, actually.
Oh, I thought you did it twice.
Great.
Oh, you went to a private cocktail party, whatever the hell it was you were describing this week. Yeah.
It was my birthday, Jim, so I had a little get-together.
Happy birthday.
But you know what's interesting?
Yeah.
It's interesting that that now that we're in these phases, I have the feeling, and I'm interested in what people think about this, that some people at least are easing up somewhat, you know, that they get together in their small groups, but that they're not quite as socially distance keeping as they were before, and especially when they're outside. I just had the sense of talking to friends over the weekend that there was a little bit, especially when you get out of Boston. I was down in Cape Cod this weekend. There's a little bit of a sense of people not quite as nervous as they used to be.
Well, did you see, by the way, that's Massachusetts, and that's what we want to talk about is people's experience here. Did you see, I was about to say Mario Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo, Governor Cuomo, tweeting, mm-hmm. don't make me come down there.
Right.
A lot of the bars and restaurants in New York City, which, remember, was were packed
mm-hmm.
with a huge number of people not wearing masks. What I do, I almost feel, it isn't like I'm about to make a citizen's arrest or something. I don't even know what I'm doing. I'm surveying the scene. I drive mm-hmm. around and see what, I have to say, the level of compliance, I don't think is abating. Common sense would suggest to me that exactly what I'm talking about in Boston for the most part, Cambridge, Boston, that sort of thing, would suggest that what you're saying is right. You see the demonstrations on TV. Okay, well, subliminally or otherwise, it's okay to go out with larger numbers of people. We're in phase two, so maybe you can let down your guard a little bit. I have to say, almost everybody I see is wearing a mask, which is really good, and most of them are doing the physical distancing thing. But I'm interested, in addition to that, and I'm interested in what people's response to your contention is too, are people making use of those things that we were all complaining were not open that now finally are, and are businesses? I mean, I don't want to name names because I don't know, but I was reading some restaurant blogs from some of the people who own restaurants, and some of them who were in agony because the good news is they're open. The bad news is they have no space to do a patio thing. And as a result, this provided nothing additional to them. They were in the same boat, delivery and takeout, assuming they could do delivery and takeout in a way that made sense. So we're interested in from both ends of the spectrum as we wait for the governor. How are you doing on the business front if you were allowed to at least partially reopen a week ago Monday? And how are you doing in terms of the putting your foot in the water thing if you're a consumer of any of these services?
And especially if you've got little kids, how happy you are about the playgrounds, or are you a nervous wreck about the playgrounds? I would think it would be wonderful to have kids go to the playgrounds and get them out of the house and not have to be running up and down the asphalt across the street from our old studio. Well, it's not our old studio. We're just not there.
It is our
but
studio.
But all the families, that the fans would drive up, the kids would spill out. It's like they'd been, you know, in a 2x3 foot, you know, corner for weeks, bounding out of the van and running up and down the asphalt for like an hour and a half. Anyway, Josh from Grafton, thank you for calling.
Hello, Josh.
Hello there.
Hi.
Long time listener, first time caller.
We love that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you guys were asking about opening up a restaurant, and I've got a restaurant out in Grafton, Mass.
Called
Reunion Tap and Table. And we were open throughout the whole throughout the lockdown for delivery and carry out, but on Monday we put a tent out in the parking lot and opened up for, you know, the limited seating.
How'd that go?
And things are going great. It's going great. Really, we're the excitement that people have had just to get out, it's incredible. The guests are all so excited and so thankful for us. It's a much different restaurant world than it was pre-COVID.
Hey, Josh, I think when you were saying the name of your place, I unfortunately, this is shocking, was talking. And I don't think we heard the first word. Say the whole name of your restaurant.
Imagine.
It's Reunion Tap and Table.
Great. So can you describe, how's the thing set up in your tent? How do you seat people and how do you deal with safety things?
We basically, what we try to do is make everything, we try to put our restaurant outside. We want to, as far as the design and stuff, we really put a lot of effort into, it's beautiful. We put flower boxes and things of that sort. Mm-hmm. But we also have a host stand out front, and everyone greets at the host stand. And of course, everyone has to wear their mask until they're seated. So that when they're seated, we basically have just continued using our online ordering system. So we don't even have servers at the moment. Our guests sit down and order the food right from their app.
Oh, that is great.
And then we bring it out. And we have a pickup stand where they can go and pick up their own food and bring it just packaged in the same way that we would a delivery order. But they can then dine at the table. And then they go to the bar where we have sneeze guards and whatnot so the bartenders can serve.
Hey, Josh, we hate to do this to you. Good luck with your restaurant. The governor has appeared. We're really happy for you, and it sounds like you got it down, and stay in touch with us. Here is Governor Baker from the State House.
This is a 90% reduction in the number of positive tests per population tested since April 15th. Roughly 1,000 people remain hospitalized due to COVID-19. That number is down over 70% since the middle of April. And yesterday's numbers were consistent with what we've been reporting over the course of the past few weeks, continued positive incremental progress. We're about a week into phase two of the reopening process. Outdoor dining, hotels, and activities like summer camps are coming back. Things may look a little different, but thanks to everyone's creativity and commitment, we're reopening and effectively bringing the fight to the virus at the same time. Our progress to date is encouraging, but it doesn't mean the virus has left town. Until there's a medical breakthrough with a treatment or a vaccine, it's up to all of us to continue to do the things that we know can kill COVID. Face coverings, hand washing, distancing, monitoring for symptoms, and getting tested when appropriate is how we fight COVID-19 and continue to reopen Massachusetts. People of the Commonwealth have done extraordinary work over the course of the past 120 days to get us to this point. And we just ask you to please keep doing all you've been doing to fight COVID while we continue to move forward here in the Commonwealth. As part of our effort to adapt to the state's response to COVID-19 and bring every resource we can to stopping the virus, our administration is going to launch 50 pop-up COVID-19 testing sites throughout the Commonwealth for individuals who have recently participated in large gatherings. These free testing sites will be available at over 50 sites throughout Massachusetts on Wednesday, June 17th and Thursday, June 18th. We're urging anyone who has attended a large gathering over the last 2 weeks to get tested for COVID-19 at one of these sites. Test results will be provided to each participant confidentially. A full list of the testing sites will be available at mass.gov/gettested. I also want to thank my friend, State Representative Carlos Gonzalez, the chair of the Black and Latino Legislative Caucus, for his advocacy around launching these testing sites. Obviously, there's been a significant increase in the number of people participating in demonstrations across Massachusetts and around the country. Thousands of people have been congregating in large groups over the past several weeks to exercise their First Amendment rights in the wake of the George Floyd murder. These gatherings are coinciding with reopening, meaning more and more people are moving around with each other. It's not the first time we've seen protesting and demonstrations during the pandemic, but it's certainly been the largest number of participants. And any time large groups of people come together, there's a risk for transmission. We certainly support people's rights to express their views peacefully. But we need to keep up our fight to slow the spread of COVID-19 here in Massachusetts. Some people who have the virus don't show symptoms and could spread the virus to others, including family members. By getting tested, you can help keep yourself and your close contacts safe from the virus. Everyone's done amazing work to keep people safe. Distancing, wearing face coverings, washing their hands, washing surfaces, scrubbing with disinfectant, and monitoring for symptoms. And the data is bearing this out. The numbers continue to show very positive progress. For individuals who have taken part in recent large gatherings, getting tested this week on one of those 2 days is another important way to play your part in slowing the spread of the virus. So please, if you're at a large gathering in the last couple of weeks, check out the website and find a testing site near you. If you're healthy and feeling fine, you should consider getting tested anyway. Preventing the spread of COVID-19 is also about protecting other people around you, moms, dads, grandparents, aunts, uncles, brothers, sisters. And I want to thank you all very much as a Commonwealth for your continued collaboration as we fight the virus. And now I'd like to turn the floor over to Secretary Sutters to provide a few more details on this announcement and other updates from the Command Center.
You're listening to 89.7 WGBH. It was Governor Charlie Baker, now Mayor Lou Sutters, Secretary of Health and Human Services, and the woman coordinating the state's coronavirus response.
As the governor said, we're encouraging individuals who've been in large gatherings over the last 2 weeks to utilize these pop-up sites this week, this Wednesday and Thursday, to get tested. The sites are available across the Commonwealth, and the Command Center has worked with healthcare partners trusted by their communities to quickly stand up over 50 sites in all parts of the Commonwealth. In fact, there's 52. They include hospitals, community health centers, and CVS. We're thankful for the cooperation of these partners who have stood these sites up quickly, which include Bay State Health, Berkshire Medical Center, Beth Israel Lahey Health, Brockton Community Health Center, Brookside Community Health Center, the Cambridge Health Alliance, Community Health Connections, CVS, Fairview Hospital, Lawrence General Hospital, Lynn Community Health Center, MGH Chelsea, Outer Cape Health Services, Manic Community Health Center, and UMass Medical. Please visit mass.gov/get-tested to find the site closest to or most comfortable for you. Throughout the pandemic, the Command Centers continue to work to expand both access to testing and the Commonwealth's testing capacity. We've increased our testing capacity to 30,000 tests per day, with 45 labs processing tests. Over the last several days, we've averaged over 10,000 individual tests per day. The administration submitted our testing strategy plan to the federal government a few weeks ago to further expand testing. The plan includes increasing lab capacity to 45,000 by the end of July, reducing and maintaining a positive test rate to less than 5%, ensuring on-demand access to testing for all symptomatic individuals and their close contacts, increasing access to testing for vulnerable and high-risk populations, such as the announcement today, building a testing infrastructure to support a potential second surge, modernizing our public technology infrastructure to provide real-time data on cases and testing, and operating best-in-class contact tracing. Testing is a critical part of our plan to stop the spread of the virus. The other important parts continue to be social distancing, face coverings, hand washing, and sanitizing. Understanding that it is difficult to engage in social distancing during a time of protests and mass gatherings, it is important that any individual who participated in a large gathering over the last few weeks get tested. It's free, and you can help stop the spread. You're helping to keep your loved ones and close contacts safe by getting tested. Also, starting today, we will provide the total number of tests that have been conducted in addition to the total number of people tested. The fact pack actually states people who have been tested, not the total tests. So to be completely clear, both will be listed starting today, total tests and total people. Thank you. Governor?
That was Mary Lou Sutters, Health and Human Services Secretary. It's back to Governor Baker.
The state is showing such positive progress the way it is. How soon can people get their nails done?
Is that a personal question or a journalistic question? I think we continue to follow the data, and I think by the time we get to the end of this week, we'll probably have an announcement to make on that.
Governor?
You know, the Lieutenant Governor and I spend a lot of time talking to our colleagues in local government about the orders, about the reopening process, about the protocols, and a lot of the feedback that we get from them goes into the way we formulate those policies and those protocols, and we try very hard to do it in a way that they believe makes it possible for them to serve as sort of the eyes and ears on the ground in their communities. And while there are communities that have done more than we've done in some cases or gone farther, for the most part, I think people at this point feel pretty confident and comfortable that they understand what we are trying to achieve. They understand the data and the feedback that they make available to us improves the quality of the guidance that we put out there, and I think generally are pretty comfortable with the role that they have. And if they have issues on this, they raise them. They either raise them with the Lieutenant Governor, they raise them with the Secretary in the Command Center, or they raise them with us.
Are there any examples of concerns they've raised that are now being either revisited or retooled?
I think a lot of the rules around outdoor dining spent a lot of time getting processed to make sure that they felt that they could actually do what they needed to do at the local level to implement it. And the development of that program that the Lieutenant Governor announced last week with respect to making resources available to communities that want to try and do something to enhance and improve the quality of the outdoor dining experience or rework some of their streetscapes came out of those conversations.
Governor, question for 2 weeks of stay, we're reporting on the antibody tests that are being performed, but have not disclosed essentially the results of those tests. Do you guys have a sense of how long that should come back percentage-wise with antibodies, and can you draw anything from that data at this point, given it's been 50,000, pretty large?
I mean, we've said before that we talked to the medical advisory board a lot about antibody testing, and it's definitely an evolving science. I don't know if you want to speak to this one, Secretary, but our view on it is we believe as it evolves, it will become, as we've said before, clearer which tests are sort of signed off on by the feds as being the most efficacious and accurate. And we're hoping to be able to include that as part of our go-forward strategy with respect to surveillance, especially around how many people have actually gotten the virus but may not have ever been reported.
Can you determine at this point it's still not reliable enough to report that data?
The Medical Advisory Board has referred to it in our conversations as an evolving technology. And on a small scale basis, for example, I think we all would agree that the work that was done by MGH in conjunction with the City of Boston, was done under sort of a controlled research environment. But if you start getting into a grander scale use of this, I think we would like to get a little more positive feedback from the advisory board.
Governor, I was wondering if I could get a comment from you on the death of a veteran.
I have two of you talking to me at once here, John.
There was a veteran that died in Bedford, a 62-year-old, and it's kind of outrageous. The veterans groups are really concerned. This guy was missing for a month and ended up being at the VA campus. It's complicated by the fact that he lived at a privately run place being leased by Caritas. Are you guys looking into this, and can you comment on it?
The answer is we've had informal conversations with the people who are involved in this. We haven't made a decision about whether to enter into a formal investigation. But obviously the whole thing is a terrible tragedy.
How about the protests? It's been about 2 weeks since the big protest in Boston occurred. About 2 weeks. I'm curious, we have yet to really see a big spike in it. Is that encouraging? Or is it really just too early to tell whether or not the protests have had an effect on the transmission?
Well, I think part of the reason we're making the announcement that we're making today is we started thinking last week about creating some mechanism to make it possible to get some sense about whether or not there was, in fact, transmission that came out of the gatherings that have taken place so far. And part of the reason for doing them in a wide variety of sites around the Commonwealth is because I think there were almost 300 events of one kind or another that took place that had more than 100 people. And as you all know, many of them had more than 1,000. And while a lot of them, people wore face coverings and they were outdoors and people were moving, there was also a lot of chanting and yelling. And those right up there with singing is one of the things that a lot of the medical community worries about. And I think this is one way of trying to encourage people to get tested, not just for themselves, but also for those who are their close contacts. And as I said, anytime you have a big group that gets together like that, it can be risky in this environment. And we would like to see what some of that data shows. Say again? I view that stuff at this point as sort of too soon to tell. I mean, it can take anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks to start to show symptoms.
What about the nuts and bolts of the testing program you're announcing today? Do people have to make an appointment? Do they just find out where it is and show up? And is there any thought to doing it over the weekend?
You know, the weekends actually end up being less great from a testing point of view.
So the 52 sites across Massachusetts, the nuts and bolts of it. If you go online, some of them are by appointment, like, and some of them are walk-ins. So we make it very clear on the website which ones are by. Some are a combination walk-in appointments, some are appointments only, some of them are walk-ins only. One of the things we asked all of our partners was to flex their time, because a number of them already have due testing. So it was very important. We didn't want to tax the testing capacity we currently have. So that we're assuming, and we would be thrilled if we actually had an additional 10,000 people tested each of the 2 days. So we've planned for an additional 10,000 each day, and have done that through expanded sites as well as expanded hours. So we were trying very hard to have early morning hours into the evening hours over Wednesday and Thursday, to sort of, and really encouraging people to go. So it's a mix.
Are too few people going out and getting tested? I mean, you have a big gap between your capacity of what the testing and the number of people who are actually showing up to get the test.
Well, as you know, last week the city of Boston provided 2 days of testing, and we're hoping to have, I think, 1,000 people a day. And I think their numbers were between 1,200 to 1,500, again, in response to the mass gatherings and protests, and they don't have their test results in, which goes to your question. So the testing that happened in Boston last week, the test results are not yet in. So between 1,200 and 1,500, they were hoping to have 1,000 a day for the two-day period, and have yet to get the test results. I'm sorry, what was the rest of that?
Yeah.
So again, you know, we want to build capacity. So in the event that we needed to flex because of mass gatherings and the like, right, you have that headroom in order to have people tested and have the lab capacity. So you always want to have more lab capacity than the ability to test, because if you all of a sudden had a surge, right, I don't want people then waiting 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 days to get the lab results back. So the ability of having capacity is the ability to then decrease the amount of time people are waiting to get their test results. That's one thing that's very important. And as we continue to open up our economy, right, more employers may want to have people tested. Universities may want to have people tested. So you want to have that capacity. So, you know, I'm the fact that we had 9,000-10,000 people yesterday tested, I think we continue to get the message out. That if you are symptomatic or asymptomatic close contacts, we want you to be tested. And we have the capacity to provide, to get the tests done.
Governor, can you share anything more about your police certification bill, like the important points that you really want to make sure you include in that?
So we've been talking to the Black and Latino Caucus now for about 6 to 9 months about implementing a certification program here in Massachusetts for law enforcement, and they have those kinds of structures in many other states. And for us, it's an issue around transparency and accountability. And I think if it hadn't been for COVID, we actually probably would have had this thing done a couple of months ago, but that got in the way. And I do think, based on the conversations that we've had with the caucus and with others, that the legislature is very interested in engaging in this discussion. And it's our hope that this legislation, after we file it, can become kind of a platform for that dialogue, and that over the course of the next 45 days or so, before the end of the formal session, we can get something passed here in Massachusetts.
Can you talk about some of the parts of it that you think are really crucial that you get to
meet? I think we'll talk more about that when we file it.
Can I throw a quick hypothetical at you? I might love to use it, but if you do see
Well, remember, the one of the main reasons we put a pretty robust contact tracing program in place was so that if we did see increases in cases, that we'd be able to make sure that we identified those cases quickly. That's part of what making this testing available is about, and then connect with and help isolate whoever their close contacts were for the same purpose. In the end, we fully expected that at some point we would start to reopen our economy and that we would try and do it on a cautious and careful basis. But the assumption there was that as that happened, as the secretary said and as the lieutenant governor said when we announced the reopening plan, we are expecting that there will be more people who will want to get tested and need to get tested. And the whole point behind expanding testing capacity and having a robust tracing program is so that we can quickly identify people who test positive, help them isolate, identify the people who are their close contacts, and help them isolate. In some cases, the close contacts can be the person that gave it to them in the first place. So I think the most appropriate thing we need to do is make sure that our testing ability can ramp and that we do have a pretty significant tracing program in place to be sure that we can actually reach out, connect with, and help those people isolate. Because the way you really get in trouble with this virus is the reproduction rate. You know, how fast does one person become 2, become 4, become 8, become 16, become 32, and the like? And that brings me back, by the way, once again, to all the messaging and all the hard work that people in Massachusetts have done with respect to distance and face coverings and hand washing and hygiene. And I can't tell you how important that stuff is as a big part of the prevention strategy. But if we do these and a bunch of people get identified, we'll work hard to make sure that we help them isolate and that we help their close contacts isolate, because that's ultimately going to be the strategy, whether it's now or in August or in September, that's going to be fundamental to our ability to limit the spread of the virus, along with all the stuff that we've always talked about doing and that people have been really collaborative and supportive of doing.
But if you do have an increase, you're ready to roll back reopening? I mean, we could have to take some steps back if it gets dangerous again?
Well, we've said all along that our goal here is to be cautious about the way we move forward and to use our testing and tracing program to make, you know, sort of quick adjustments to deal with hotspots or issues of significance, either that involve particular populations or issues that involve particular geographies and communities. And we would much prefer that strategy than some other.
Governor, what's been your personal experience with the reopening? Shopping? Have you gone out to eat?
I got a haircut. I was actually pretty excited about that. The Lieutenant Governor went out to her family went out to their favorite restaurant and ate in a parking lot, and you said it was beautiful. I haven't really done much of that stuff yet. Yeah. So I think we announced this a few weeks ago, that there is a major national effort on behalf of some very sophisticated fraudsters, for lack of a better word, who are using stolen identifications, probably part of some of the large previous breaches that have happened, to basically bomb unemployment agencies with very credible data associated with particular individuals to seek to collect unemployment. And we've been working with the federal government and with other states who are dealing with this issue, and basically the end game here is to put a number of additional steps in place, which we understand create timing issues for people. And I wish that was avoidable, but we have to make sure that people are who they say they are. And that means, you know, there's usually, in many cases, a second touch, in some cases a third touch, to confirm that they are, in fact, the person that they're supposed to be before we can make payment. They don't lose anything in terms of their total value of what they're eligible for, but it does cost them in some cases days before we can get around to sending them the money, because we need to validate that they are who they say they are. These people have really good data who are playing this game, and they are very sophisticated, and it's very important to us as one of the states that got ahead of this, that was one of the first states to create a pandemic unemployment assistance program, one of the first states to do the 13-week extension for the people who'd already exhausted their existing unemployment benefits and put together a very significant remote call center to help the people on traditional UI. We know how important these benefits are, but we absolutely positively have to make sure that that this money goes to the people it's intended to go to and not to these people who are trying to rip the system off. I'm not going to speak to any of the specifics on that. Washington was, in fact, sort of the canary in the coal mine on this. It was their experience that led to notifications that went to other states, including ours, to give us a heads up that we really needed to get aggressive about making sure that there was representation on this stuff. But like I said, it's very important to us that people get the money they're entitled to, but it's also very important to us that they, in fact, be the people that their application says they are. I was glad to see the Supreme Court ruling. I was also glad to see that it was 6-3. And I think certainly here in Massachusetts, but I would argue across the country, it's important for people to not have their employment status jeopardized by their gender identity, their sexual persuasion, or their sex. And I actually think the way this decision was worded, and I haven't read the whole thing, I've only read some of what I've seen in the news, the basic thrust of the court's opinion was your performance at work should be about your performance at work, period. And discriminating against somebody, not giving somebody a job, taking a job away from somebody simply because of anything that has to do with their sex, their gender identity, or their sexual persuasion is against federal law. And I thought that was terrific. I was glad to see it.
Thank you. We have been listening to...
That appears to be it. Actually, just to touch on the end, the last question Governor Baker was asked about, the 6-3 Supreme Court decision saying that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 64 covers employees who are gay, lesbian, transgender, and he was an enthusiastic supporter. He started today, the governor, with his usual reporting on average positive test rate, which is down to 3%. Which he said is 90% below its peak, hospitalization down 70% from their peak. The primary purpose of today's gathering was to announce that for people who have gone to mass rallies, that there'll be 50 pop-up testing sites free of charge. They'll be open this Wednesday and Thursday. And if you go to mass.gov/get-tested, let me say it again, mass.gov/get-tested, you can get a free test. And as the governor said, since we've all learned about people who are asymptomatic, even if you feel healthy, if you've been to those gatherings, he strongly urges you to go get a free test. By the way, he also referred, this is a man who chooses his language very carefully. When he talked about the protests, Marjorie, he referred to George Floyd's murder. He did not say the killing of George Floyd. He said George Floyd's murder. Which, yeah. Again, from a man who chooses words very carefully. Mary Lou Sutter, Secretary of Health and Human Services, says those 50 pop-up sites will include hospitals, community health centers, CVSs, that sort of thing. He was asked, as he has been many a time, about antibody testing, and he kept saying the medical advisory board says that the science is evolving. And I think that means, in English, don't count on it. For the time being, the virus tests were overwhelmingly reliable. The antibody tests, not so terribly reliable. And then he said, and I hope I'm not reading too much. So that was the major purpose of the day. He announced the 50 pop-up testing sites around the state. Go to mass.gov/get-tested for people who went to the rallies, the gatherings, even if they feel perfectly fine. He was asked a question, I can't remember, about getting your nails done or something like that. And he said, it's possible I'll have something later in the week. And so if you recall, Marjorie, there's a part two to phase two. And when they announced phase two on Saturday of last week, and that it would start on June 8th. I think it was one of the people, I can't remember, who was working on the reopening committee. It said, we will announce the second part of phase two, which anxiously is being awaited for. I think that's massage treatment, nail salons, that sort of thing. So apparently, by the end of the week, if there continues to be progress on the testing and the hospitalization front, another announcement about further reopenings will be happening. I think that's essentially what we heard from Governor Baker and Mayor Lou Sutters. Yes,
I think you summarized it very well, Jim.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
By the way, for those who listen to the show regularly for years, everything the governor did, Marjorie, because she's a detailed person who, from her days of reporting, would do the summaries. And I, of course, as anybody would be, was grossly offended that she was doing 19 years of summaries. And I seized the summaries about a month ago.
I'm happy that you have.
Consider them seized. In any case, what's coming up, Marjorie Egan?
Okay, what's coming up is our TV man, Bob Thompson. He's with us with his best and worst and what you should watch this week. Bob Thompson next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Last week, Dave Chappelle released a surprise Netflix special titled 8:46, as in 8 minutes and 46 seconds. In the show, which Chappelle acknowledges is not being funny at all, Chappelle drops the jokes to make room for his scathing commentary on the murder of George Floyd, police brutality, and racism in America.
Candace Owens. She's the worst. I can't think of a worse way to make money. She's the most articulate idiot I've ever seen in my f***ing life. She's so articulate, she can tell you how f***ing stupid she is precisely. And she told George Floyd's rap record on the internet. Oh, he was this, he did that, and he's a drug addict, and he's not a hero. And why does the black community make him a hero? Why do you choose him as a hero? We didn't choose him. You did. They killed him, and that wasn't right, so he's the guy. We're not desperate for heroes in the black community. Any that survives this nightmare is my goddamned hero.
Join us online to talk about this and other TV headlines is Bob Thompson. Bob's a professor and founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hello there, Bob Thompson.
Hello. How are you two?
We're good. Thank you.
Hey, we're very good, Bob Thompson. So glad to talk to you. So what's your best this week?
Well, the Chappelle surprise special gets my best.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things. I mean, this is Dave Chappelle at his most potent. He struts out smoking a cigarette. He uses some words to describe women that are alarming. But I think it was really great to hear his voice. And this thing was shot socially distanced, but shot in Ohio on June 6th. And it surprised us. It drops on the 11th of June. And it's a Netflix show, but it didn't play on Netflix. It played on YouTube for free, so anybody could watch it. 8:46, of course, is the amount of time the knee was on George Floyd. And as Dave Chappelle points out, 8:46 was also the time that he was born.
You know, as I said in the lead to this thing, there's nothing funny about this. This is 27 minutes of social commentary, but I have to say, there is nobody like Dave Chappelle. Plus, he tells stories about a cop pulling him over in Ohio where he lives the day before that same cop kills somebody in Ohio down the road from him. Talks about his great-grandfather visiting the White House. I mean, it is a rich, incredibly powerful 27 minutes. And I like to think, even if I weren't a huge fan of his, which I am, that I would feel the same way. But it is really, really... it's something. It really is powerful.
It is. It's densely packed, and as you point out, it's stand-up, but it's not stand-up comedy.
So, Bob Thompson, speaking about the same subject matter, there have been a ton of response on television, an attempt to get with the program. Give us a couple of examples of some of the changes being made as a result of the uproar over Floyd and so many who came before and now somebody who's come after it.
Well, they're all over the place. And just like the virus took things that were changing and accelerated them at a very, very quick rate with regards to use of technology and doing things online and all the rest of it, all of these changes that have been dragging on for so long, it looks like may have been very much accelerated by the George Floyd story. I suppose the one that got most of the attention earlier in the week was Gone with the Wind being pulled by HBO Max, not being eliminated, not taking it away, but being pulled with the idea that they would re-release it with a introduction that contextualizes it, which I think is an absolutely great idea. I think that should be done with lots of other things that play from times gone by. And it's been announced what they're going to, who's going to be doing it. Jacqueline Stewart, a University of Chicago professor, again, my alma mater, who many might know if they watch the wonderful Turner Movies Classics cable channel. She does the intros for Sunday night silent films. So I suspect she's going to do something similar to that, which will be appended to the Gone with the Wind playing. That has not yet been released. It's still not up yet, but it's expected to be before too much longer. Then, of course, Amazon is considering pulling Dukes of Hazzard from its streaming. As you recall, Dukes of Hazzard was about a bunch of good old boys, as they say in the theme song, who drive around a car called the General Lee, which has a big Confederate flag painted on the top of it. I checked this morning, however, and you can still watch Dukes of Hazzard on Amazon, so that hasn't happened. And then I guess to go to the most ridiculous show, The Bachelor. In the midst of all this, The Bachelor, at long last, has announced that it's going to have a black bachelor, which will be the first time in its 18 years, although there was a black bachelorette prior to that.
You know, somebody texted me, a friend of mine last night, said how ridiculous it was. And I don't know if we've discussed
so.
With you, but let me get the thought out. And we've discussed this a lot with others of our guests. One of the ways you change the culture is through media. And if they've been there, whatever it is, 30 years or whatever the hell, 20 years, The Bachelor has been there, and there's never been a black guy before, it's a statement. I mean, it's not. I've never watched a show, so I don't really know. But,
well, I've watched the show since the day it started with a good deal of glee and delight. And when I said ridiculous, I was referring to The Bachelor as ridiculous.
No, I understand that. I wasn't directing you.
And a lot of people say, oh, well, what, it took George Floyd for you to finally do this? And people have been complaining about diversity issues on The Bachelor for a long, long time. But I guess better late than never. If someone says, I've quit beating my children, I suppose you're happy with that news. I think this is an important step, again, within a silly franchise, which we've given lots of worse to many times. But, yes, I agree with you. It was an important announcement.
Bob Thompson, I was wondering, though, who is the demographic for The Bachelor? I would think it would be younger people, teens, early 20s, that kind of thing.
Well, it's a network television show, so network television tends to skewer older. If you look at the super fans, Bachelor Nation, as they call it so proudly, the people who are in the audience when they had the live broadcasts and all of that, that does tend to be a younger audience. But as a network show, it also tends to skew. Network television averages all across the schedule in the 50s and into the 60s.
You know, and the other thing is, what's that?
That's what I was going to say. That's why I wondered who the demographic is, because often these things impact, you know, when you watch shows with your kids, and whether it's something like this or other things that were on the networks, it's a discussion, right? Isn't it, between the parents and the kids or the teenagers, and that you got a black guy as the main
person. Or it's
person.
Just there, where it wasn't before. I mean, you know, it does make a difference. I have to say, speaking of just there, I was actually going to start watching Cops in its 31st season. I've never seen it in the first 30. But apparently, here's a clip from a show that I literally have never seen. But then I read last night, one of the highest rated shows on cable, I guess. Here's a clip from Cops, and I'm sure you've all read this reality TV show, just been canceled after 3 decades. Here it is.
The male caller and his ex-girlfriend, he stated that she broke into his apartment.
He's breaking everything.
Have a seat. Have a seat.
What's going on? He broke everything. Look.
Have a seat. Talk to my partner. What's going on? What the?
She defecated on the floor, throwing it everywhere. What's wrong with her?
Over here now. She got restraining on.
Oh, I know I'm not, sir. I'm not doing nothing wrong. I just came to get my stomach.
So talk about who's the demographic. One, this I think I'm right that it was quite popular. Who watched this thing?
Well, it had a broad audience. So when this started back in 1989, there were a lot fewer choices. It was on television, and that's where you watch TV. There was no streaming. There weren't nearly as many options as we've got now. So over the years, this has been watched. I mean, 1989 has been watched by generations of people. There have been complaints about Cops for a long time that it presented one set of people, the cops that it followed and that were in the title of the show. They were, of course, the protagonists, and that it followed the community of people who they were taking calls on in ways that were often filled with stereotypes, even though this was a documentary or schlockumentary, as we might call it. But the idea that it was very much from one point of view and that it tended to present people, much like the talk shows like Maury Povich and Jerry Springer and those kinds of things. People often laughed at the behavior of the people that were being pulled over or chased or whatever. I don't have any real – I'm not mourning the fact that Cops has been canceled after all of these years. And I think there's some sensitivity in the decision to really rethink shows like that. Then we've got, of course, on A&E, PD Live, which has been canceled. And that's got all kinds of weird stories about how they were, in fact, covering a story where somebody was murdered and the tape disappeared and they erased it because they only kept it for the length of time they keep it. That's also been canceled. And that was a very big hit on A&E. There is, however, a tendency, and I'm putting this as a very, very complicated worst, the tendency now to say that the entire genre of cop shows, which, of course, let's remember, in dramas, you've got doctors, lawyers, detectives, and cops. Those were the big four pillars of what has constituted, from radio days up through today, the big genres of dramatic television. And I don't think the idea of eliminating police oriented the genre entirely is a good idea. In fact, I think this is a time when we could really reinvigorate that genre. Fiction and art can put experience to the data that history and journalism give us, and I could see this as the start of a whole new era of cop shows that deal with all the issues that we've been hearing discussed over the past weeks in ways that they haven't done before, but they've slouched towards on occasion. It would be like to point out, rightly so, that the American family used to be represented by Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best, the Ozzie and Harriet Show, the Donna Reed Show, and that was a completely inaccurate depiction of what the average American family was. So let's quit making TV about the American family. I think the solution was, let's start making TV that reflects what the American family experience is. Different kinds of families, not all in the suburbs, not all two people in their first marriages with two kids and a dog, not all living in single family detached housing things in some any suburb USA with Edenic names like Mayfield and Springfield and that kind of thing. And I think the family sitcom actually did begin to move in that direction over the 70s. I think this could be a renaissance for police television shows to do the very kind of consciousness raising that we're hearing in the discussions on the news over the past couple of weeks.
Well, but some of it already exists. You don't have to start from scratch. I mean, we've discussed before the arguably the greatest television show ever, The Wire. I mean, talk about a time to watch The Wire if you haven't watched it before, or watch it again if you have watched it before. I mean, that does exactly what you're talking about, don't
right,
you think?
And that's where this gets complicated.
Because
Why? It is true. People that are saying all police shows simply glorify the police, that hasn't been true for a long, long time. If we go back to Jack Webb and Dragnet, which started in radio and moved to television in the 1950s and was rebooted in the 1960s and was rebooted again, not terribly successfully, by Dick Wolf several years ago. If we look at shows like Chips or T.J. Hooker, yes, those were all about kind of these perfect cops who were always doing good things. But the whole explosion of literate television began in 1981 with Hill Street Blues, which was filled with bad-behaving cops. The Shield, one of cable's big breakthrough shows, was about a very, very, very bad cop. And The Wire, as many people have pointed out, showed the very complex relationship between power, law enforcement, and the community. But there are some making the argument, and some making it fairly convincingly, that even in those cases, because the featured characters are the protagonists, that we kind of move to a certain identification with them. And I suppose you could make the argument that, you know, we kind of rooted for Tony Soprano, and he was a mob boss. And I think there is some argument to be made that the star, that the head lead character in a show like The Shield, even though he did despicable things, right off from the pilot episode where he murders one of his own fellow cops, point blank, that there's a sense in which there is some way in which we identify with these bad guys. So I'm rambling, but it's a complicated, complicated issue.
We're talking to Bob Thompson, our TV guy. Tell us about ESPN's 30 for 30 on Bruce Lee.
Yeah, okay. Well, last night, 30 for 30 just ended its string of they kind of fast-tracked airing new 30 for 30s because they wanted to keep that time slot hot after it had been warmed up by The Last Dance, that multi-part series about Michael Jordan that we talked about before.
Yep.
So after that ended, they did a two-part on Lance Armstrong, followed a week ago by Be Water about Bruce Lee, and last night, Long Gone Summer, about the Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa 1998 home run derby that was the big, you know, kind of redemption of baseball after the strike in 94. Long Gone Summer last night was awfully celebratory. The director himself does a little intro in the beginning that he wanted to kind of relive how exciting this was. They didn't get to the steroids until the last 15 minutes of a two-hour show. But a week before that, the Bruce Lee thing called Be Water did what 30 for 30 can be so good at when it's at its best. It dealt with the racism of Hollywood, the inability for Bruce Lee to get leading roles. He always had to be sidekicks, even though he was extraordinarily talented, did a big hit back home. And it was one of those things that I have to say, when I was done watching the Bruce Lee thing, I thought this was even better than the Michael Jordan series had been.
Yeah, I didn't know that he had been so excluded by Hollywood and how he had, as you say, had to go back home. And then was there only one American Hollywood-made movie? Was it Enter the Dragon or whatever it was that
was the only one? There were very few. I mean, he appeared in things, but he always kind of played the sidekick. Anyway, if I don't think ESPN has put that on demand yet, but probably within a couple of days. They usually put them on fairly quickly. It's, I mean, there have been many, many wonderful 30 for 30s, but this is an example of how good this documentary can be when it's at its best.
Bob Thompson, before we get to what to watch this week, tell us what Oprah's doing.
She did a two-part Tuesday and Wednesday called OWN Spotlight, Where Do We Go From Here? Colon, a conversation led by Oprah. And Oprah is just so good at this. She had all kinds of leaders of the black community, celebrities, directors, community activists, Stacey Abrams, Ava DuVernay, David Oyelowo, Charles Blow, on and on and on. And it was pretty much done in the idiom of Oprah. She was in at home, I guess, and she was talking to all these people online, but they were solid discussions. The 2 hours of these two parts did the kind of thing that universities across the country now are desperately trying to put together so that when students come back, they can have these discussions that have some kind of value and that actually get to issues and get people to think about things that they hadn't thought about before. And this kind of did it nationally. And even though Oprah may not be at the center of the American consciousness that she was when she had her daily show, if you combine the 17 different Discovery-owned channels that this played on in the two episodes, and then the people that watched it online, got about estimated 17.6 million people.
Wow.
That's a big, big number.
Yeah. So we're almost out of time here, but what should we watch this week?
American Masters tomorrow on PBS. Dirty Blonde,
the story
of Mae West, 90 minutes. And Mae West, you know, a lot of people only know her as, you know, come up and see me sometime, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But her career is a fascinating, multifaceted, extraordinary body of work. And I think for those who know her, this is a really fine way of putting it all together. And for those who don't, it's a story really well worth being introduced to.
We have a little bit of sound from Dirty Blonde. Here it is.
Mae West crafted this image. She was a sexual gangster.
You're a dangerous woman.
Thanks.
She had that walk in. I'm here, lads. Take me or take me.
Are you in town for good?
I expect to be here, but not for good.
She's a parody of unbridled male sexuality.
Good night.
She's standing sexism on its head.
It's their game. I happen to be smart enough to play it their way.
She was 40 years old before she ever appeared in a movie.
Goodness, what beautiful diamond. Goodness had nothing to do with it, dearie.
She waltzed in and said, I wrote it, and we're going to shoot it like this, kid.
I love that.
I love it because it sounds like she was such a take charge person completely.
She appeared on an episode of the Edgar Bergen show that got her banned from radio back in the day.
Bob, thanks. We'll be watching. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bob Thompson joins us every week. He's the founding director of the Blair Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Coming up, Mayor Walsh has declared racism a public health crisis. Now comes the hard part, finding out how to treat it. The Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price join us for that and more on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And President Trump, as you know, has decided to move his rally in Tulsa, move it back a day. And, of course, Tulsa is the site of the 1921 race massacre. Amid outcry over its clash with the Juneteenth holiday, marking the end of U.S. slavery. On Friday, Trump tweeted, quote, many of my African-American friends and supporters have reached out to suggest that we consider changing the date out of respect for his holiday. The question being, who are these African-American friends of his? Joining us online for their take on this, the murder of Rayshard Brooks and more, Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. They join us every week for All Revved Up. Reverend Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist and a visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU's School of Theology. Reverend Price is professor and executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience, Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, and they're both the hosts of the All Revved Up podcast. Irene Emmett, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, glad to be here. And what a great day for transgendered rights, for LGBTQ rights today.
Well, why don't you, that's what I was going to ask you about that, Irene, but go ahead. The Supreme Court decision, tell people about it.
Yeah, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 not only protects folks in the workplace because of race, but also because of sex. And it's no longer this issue of if you're a trans person, it doesn't apply to you. So this was a good day. This was a 6-3 decision.
It's amazing.
And
yeah.
We were really concerned about this, meaning the LGBT community. Gorsuch, I was like, oh, my God. I couldn't believe it because, you know, two of the Supreme Court justices are picked by Trump.
Well, one of them went with the majority. That was Gorsuch who ended up writing the decision.
Yeah.
And the other, Kavanaugh, did not. Kavanaugh was with the three. Emmett, how hard is it for you to listen to Irene when she has nothing but positive things to say about something?
Hey, Jim, I was very quiet. I love these moments. I love when she's happy and the world is happy, and this is a moment for humanity to take one step forward.
You know, can I just say one thing about this? I've mentioned this to you guys before. I read a book about the Supreme Court many, many, many years ago. Did Woodward write a book about the Supreme Court, Marjorie?
Yes, he did.
I think it was Woodward's book. And they were talking about the Muhammad Ali decision, which you remember was 9-0. And the point of the writer was every observer, every clerk with whom they spoke said it was purely a function of politics, not the law. And there's almost nobody with whom I spoke who thought there was any chance of this being even 5-4, much less 6-3. So my sense was that they realized how the world is changing around them. And even if in normal times someone like Gorsuch and maybe Roberts would not vote with a majority, that today they decided that the political consensus forming in this country is one which forced them to protect trans, gay, and lesbian workers like anybody else in the workplace. Do you not think that makes sense, you guys?
I agree with you, Jim, in many ways, but I think that what you create in this kind of conversation is a false dichotomy.
Meaning what?
Because someone like me, who is also in the LGBT community and the African-American community, there's that – you ready, Marjorie?
Intersectionality.
That's right. There's
okay.
That intersectionality. And one of the things that you really got to understand and the way in which white supremacy operates is that it targets the particularity of different demographic groups, but it doesn't mean that we're not oppressed. So while I am quite upset about another African-American brother shot down on the streets of America, I am rejoicing at the same time that this here legislation has been moved forward. And we got to understand that LGBT rights get their sort of the playbook for LGBT rights is very much comes out of the Black Civil Rights Movement. This is, you know, this is Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, but Emmett, you know, I'm sure you read Irene's terrific piece in the Boston Globe that is really relevant
about this.
To this conversation.
Yeah.
There's a line in there, despite the Black and LGBTQ communities' shared history of struggle, they have not always been staunch allies. That's almost an understatement, Emmett, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, it's a definite understatement. It's a beautiful piece written by Irene as well. I think the challenge is that we have so much segmentation.
I agree.
Go back to the feminist movement, and then you have, you know, the womenists who have come out of that because the Black women and the women of color get left out. And so all these sections, you know, regarding the intersections, we have to do better. But her piece is right on the money, and it's true.
Yeah,
but I don't want it to demonize the fact that when I talk about that the Black community and the LGBT community have not been allies, let's understand that within the LGBTQ community, racism is as rampant in that community as it is in the larger dominant community. So that's part of the Black community, whether straight or gay, being aligned with the LGBT movement, because we see it as staunchly white, and we don't make those the necessary connections.
Well, by the way, as you know, but I'm not sure every listener knows, some of the huge demonstrations the last few days, including in Brooklyn, were led by the black trans community, making exactly the point that you're making, Irene, that they've felt like they were almost the stepchild of this whole movement through the years, and their position over the last few days was no more.
Right, and you know, we wouldn't have that movement were not those black drag queens in that era, you know, said to the police, we had enough. And what is not told, because I say in the article, you know, I was in that riot.
Yeah,
that
what yes.
Is that what happened is that that they always hit the gay bars, but they did particularly hit the black gay bar, the only one, really, more so because it was black. And you got to understand, this was 1969. We had the Black Power movement. King had died a year earlier. So there was always this tension. We've always, both communities, LGBTQ and the black community, have always had a shared history of violence and police brutality.
So, you know, Irene, if you don't mind my asking, and when you are a woman, of course, I don't know how sensitive you are about your age, but you had to be really young at that riot.
That's right. I was 13 years old in 1969. I had just graduated from middle school. I thought I was going to get left back because I talked a lot in class.
Shocking.
And, you know,
no. No.
Yeah, they said I didn't show self-control. Could you imagine?
So that must be, but to be 13 years old at that moment in history had to have a huge impact on everything.
Absolutely, because first of all, at that point, I didn't know I was gay, but the point was is that we were going down to Greenwich Village, which we thought was in Connecticut, to get our lead vocalist of the choir.
This is from Brooklyn she's talking about, by the way, everybody. Go ahead.
We're coming from Brooklyn. We're living in the housing projects. We don't have cars. We're trying to figure out why in the world would Birdie go to Connecticut, you know? And then someone had to tell us, look, it's Greenwich Village. We're still thinking it's a village within Greenwich, Connecticut. And they say, no, the village is in downtown Manhattan.
We're talking to Irene Monroe. And
that's
by the way, you should read
it's a
Irene's
great column.
Piece. Terrific
yeah, it's
piece
a great
in the Boston Globe. So can we come back to Boston for a minute? We can go from Brooklyn to Greenwich, Connecticut to Boston, Massachusetts. Emmett, what did you think of the mayor the other day declaring that racism was a public health crisis?
I thought this was a great day for Boston and a great day for Mayor Walsh. You know, I think that it's indicative of where we are in society, that someone has to step forward and really talk about the wholeness and the health and the wellness of black folks. And I'm glad that he did it. You know, he's going to move $3 million from the police department's overtime budget to public health, yeah, which I think is a step in the right direction. I think we need more money. I know there's an additional $9 million that perhaps may be on the way. Mm-hmm. But I think in terms of signaling to the nation and signaling to the world, this puts Boston at the forefront, and I think it was a great move.
Irene?
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but I will say this here. I'm very delighted that it's not symbolism, that it is really about policy change, because there's a lot that needs to be changed within, you know, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The incarceration rate among blacks is seven times that of the white population. What is the household mean is $8 in terms of compared to what, 250,000
wealth in Boston, white. The average wealth yeah. of a black family versus a white family, it is
yeah.
unbelievable.
And,
yeah,
and I as a working class black sister only make 52 cents on every dollar that a white man makes. So Jim, you need to pay up.
Okay.
Well, you know,
message this received, Irene.
But there's okay. something else about this public health crisis thing, which I think a lot of us hadn't thought of. We were talking with Chris Dempsey, our transportation guy, earlier in the show about this, that, you know, African-Americans have been hit much harder than many other people by the coronavirus. And, of course, a part of coronavirus is a lung disease. And we were talking with Chris Dempsey about how many African-Americans and people and other people of color live in the most polluted parts of our country, you know, inhaling all these particles all day long. So they're getting lung disease and asthma and all these other respiratory ailments, making them more, susceptible to coronavirus because of the pollution that surrounds where they live. I mean, that is a public health crisis, too, and I don't think we think about that very often.
Well,
what do you make of it, Emmett?
It's an absolute public health crisis until gentrification, because once those areas that are, you know, in those situations that you mentioned, Marjorie, once they are gentrified, then all of a sudden they get cleaned up.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, you know, like a snap of a finger, all of a sudden it's like, you know, the folks come through and it's like the old cartoon where the person takes the paintbrush and the old scene becomes in Technicolor. You know, it's an amazing thing that happens. And so it is a definitive crisis. I think it's even bigger than a public health situation. But I think this is a move in the right direction.
Yeah. You know, I agree with you, Emmett, because one of the things, the first sign that gentrification is taking place here, Whole Foods and Starbucks. Because whenever those two shops come, you know that is that, and they will take out Dunkin' Donuts. You know that's a clear sign that whatever filth that we have lived, had to contend with, is going to be immediately addressed.
Okay, let's talk about something else in Boston. Sometimes I think I'm living in outer space, all the things I don't notice all around me. But there has been this statue, which I had to really think hard about today, in Park Square for years, with Abraham Lincoln, of course, the former president known as the Great Emancipator, as piece by Megan Iron points out, standing over a black man on his knees. And it's supposed to be about his freeing the slaves. But this young man, who's become quite a social influencer in Dorchester, Tory Bullock, has started this effort to get rid of this statue. So, Emmett, weigh in on this one.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to get rid of it. I think, you know, I think it should have a new home, you know, somewhere where all of these things, because whatever artist did it, you know, had some kind of inspiration. And you know, I'm not big on censorship of art, but it does not need to be in the public square. It does not need to be in a public place as it is. And the idea that slaves were submissive, they took a knee to Abraham Lincoln, the great emancipator. You're right. I think it needs this out of the public display. I think it's a shameful eyesore for who Boston is becoming.
Did you both know that this, Irene, before you comment, did you both know that this was there before this?
I didn't.
Oh, yeah.
I never
you
noticed.
Both did?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you know? Just like we know of the sort of Confederate, you know, piece on Martha's Vineyard in Oak Bluff. But I think the thing with the Lincoln piece I thought was very, very interesting because, you know, as I've always said here, is that if you're below the Mason-Dixon line, it's down south, and if you're above it, you're up south. But it really, to me, shows the conflicted history around slavery. Either he freed the slaves or he didn't. And what we don't understand, most of us don't, that it only applied to states that seceded from the Union, and that slavery was really sort of left untouched in those loyal border states, and it exempt part of the Confederacy that had already become under, you know, Northern control here. But this is the problem. This is what I say is the problem here, a lot of it. I think that if we make Juneteenth a national holiday, we wouldn't have these Confederate statues and flags. We wouldn't have the kind of confusion that we have around the lost myth, the lost cause myth. I think that if that was a national holiday of independence, as July 4th, people would be clear that, yes, we did win the war. Because I always feel that the North won the war, but the South won the narrative.
By the way, on Juneteenth, for a second, you do. I didn't see Chuck Todd yesterday, and in case he's listening, don't worry, I taped it, Chuck. Did Tim Scott, who's the point person on this, surprisingly, in the Senate, did he not say to Chuck yesterday that he thought making Juneteenth a federal holiday was a, quote, brilliant idea? Am I not right about this?
I don't know.
I can't speak on it.
Well, while you're talking, I'm going to check, because if it's true, I would assume the House Democrats would be supportive, and I would assume that paints McConnell into a position. So this may actually happen. But go ahead,
yeah,
Marjorie. I'm
sorry. I taped it, too. You know, Emmett, you mentioned you're not a big person on censoring art. So what do we do with these statues, assuming they are going to come down? Do we put them in a museum or what? Emmett?
Did we lose Emmett?
You may have lost him because he's, you know, Emmett is outside in his garden, and he's outside watering his grass. That's okay.
Well, while we're waiting for him to reconnect,
what do you think? Yeah.
Well, I think two things here. I think, you know, Monument Row in Richmond, Virginia, really needs to go. Really needs to go. But, you know, the interesting thing, if you ever go to Germany, you know, you don't have those monuments and stuff, on display. And that's one of the things about having a kind of museum. You know, a museum allows you to not desecrate the history and desecrate that moment, but it certainly allows us to understand that why this should not be in the public square. I think that that's important. That's why I think that there's also been this kerfuffle about Faneuil Hall. You know, do we rename it? Do we not? But the point about it is that we got to understand that white supremacy is in every sort of crack and cranny of American life here. So if we're really about trying to make a really sea change and paradigm shift around we will no longer center white supremacy, I think it is important then to tell the correct history, because what we've been under the umbrella of is revisionist history.
You know, by the way, I just want to clarify. I just read two stories while you two were speaking. One says that Senator Scott from South Carolina told Chuck Todd yesterday that he was, quote, open to the idea of making Juneteenth a federal holiday. And another one said it was a brilliant idea. So I'm not sure which is which, but when we speak to Chuck on Thursday, we will get to the bottom. We're speaking Irene Monroe, and we may be speaking Emmett Price. We're not sure.
I just sent him a text. But can I just say this about Tim Scott? I find Tim Scott in the same camp as I find Ben Carson and Clarence Thomas. They're white supremacists in that they have the power. I mean, they perpetuate a white supremacist ideology in blackface. I hate to say that, but they have the power to affect policy and change. Why would Tim Scott sort of, you know, equivocate on this? I mean, really?
You know, I mean, I often talk when I'm talking with you and Emmett about how much I didn't learn in history that I should have learned. You mentioned we were talking. Well, I don't know if you mentioned it. Somebody mentioned we were talking about Tulsa. That 60 Minutes did a piece last night about Tulsa, where the that Greenwood section of Tulsa where there was the massacre of depending on who's counting 300, 350, 400 people. That place burned down. A very well off black community. It was so nicknamed the Black Wall Street. And the reason I mention it is because toward the end of the presentation, the 60 Minutes reporter was talking to a group of people from Tulsa, including this young black man who was from Tulsa, who said he hadn't learned about it in school himself in Tulsa. I mean, it's just incredible.
Yeah, that was a huge race riot, you know, that happened on Memorial Day, which made the killing of George Floyd come to fore even that more, you know, succinctly in terms of the constant killing of black people. Listen, I need to tell you the truth. As one who's always sort of tried to be on top of black history, I never
Emmett's
knew
back.
That there was
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
A Black Wall Street. So I'm going to let Emmett, you know, jump in on this because I know this is a topic that he loves talking about. But, you know, Tulsa, what I just want for Tulsa folks that are alive, I want some form of reparation here because that Greenwood section was decimated, you know, in 1921.
Yep.
It was the worst, one of the worst race riots in, you know, in the 20th century.
Emmett, are you back with us?
I'm back. I'm sorry about that. Yeah.
Do you want to, Marjorie was talking about the 60 Minutes piece and how a young black man was at a community meeting, and the reporter for 60 Minutes asked him about it. And he, who grew up in Tulsa, correct me if I'm wrong, Marjorie, hadn't seen it, knew nothing about what happened 99 years ago in his own city.
He didn't learn it in school.
Oh, my apologies.
That's what he
didn't
said.
Learn it.
Which was, which you know, and in Tulsa, which kind of underscores how history is distorted.
And by the way, I don't know whether to believe it or not, Tim Scott also said that Donald Trump, in terms of the Tulsa rally now scheduled for Saturday, didn't know that Juneteenth fell on Friday, nor did he know what had happened in Tulsa. But, you know, Emmett, Irene just said you're a student of this. My guess is that the vast majority of Americans didn't know about what happened there until Donald Trump said he was going there on Friday.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, Donald Trump is responsible for a whole lot of great things, right? I mean, you know, I'm using air quotes here. You know, next year, 2021, will be the centennial of this horrific moment that really disputes some of the stereotypes that we have in the nation. One, that black folks have never been successful and that we've needed people, presidents like, you know, President Donald Trump to help us to get ahead. There were so many black millionaires and well-off people during the Tulsa massacre. There were black banks, there were black businesses, black philanthropy was moving in this time. Yeah. And that's what makes the massacre so huge, that the white inhabitants of the area who were staunchly, you know, white supremacists were really frustrated by the success of black people economically, socially, spiritually, and they clearly decimated this neighborhood, community, area, and then wiped it out of history so that it has not been taught. And here we're coming up on the 100th anniversary next year. I mean, it's awful that we don't know this.
Was there I understand the overall animus, Emmett, we don't have a huge amount of time. Was there a specific thing that triggered it, or was it just the sort of big picture?
Well, I mean, it was a couple of things that happened, and very similar to the Red Summer of 1919, the year after the plague of 1918. You know, we're at the end of World War II. You know, the Ku Klux Klan was rising, and because there had been so much thriving in this area, the white supremacists began lynching in the area. And then there were certain ordinances, city ordinances, that were moving around. And so it was kind of a perfect storm for just melee and massacre, unfortunately.
And what lit the fire?
You know, we have less than a minute left.
What lit the fire was what? Quickly, say it.
The classic trope of a black man harassing a white woman, and that was it. Because they went looking for this mysterious black man.
Yeah, Dick Rowland was his name. He was 19 years old. He was a black shoe shiner.
Before we're out of time, Emmett, I want to tell you, you're doing something special tomorrow. Tell us quickly what it is before we say goodbye.
There's a panel that we're doing can you hear me?
Yep.
In association with the Front Porch, which is a phenomenal black-run theater organization, as well as Backstage. And we're going to do a reprise of a conversation that we did probably about 5 months ago, as a result of the play Passover, which has two black male perspectives of what's going on in the times. And with COVID-19 and all the protests, we're going to kind of reawaken that conversation and have it again tomorrow, you know, online, as it were.
Speakeasy's Facebook page tomorrow night at 5:00.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Emmett. Thank you, Irene. I think we've lost Marjorie. Have we lost Marjorie? We have Bill Buford has written a fabulous book, former literary editor of The New Yorker. He's now written a book. He and his family and his kids moved to France. It's called Dirt. It's about French cuisine in Lyon, but it's got much bigger implications. Stick around for Bill Buford right here on Boston Public Radio. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. In Bill Buford's latest book, he and his family travel to Lyon, which is considered the gastronomic capital of the world, and they end up extending their six-month trip to a five-year-long stay. As a travel adventure, culinary voyage, and history of French cooking, it's either the perfect escape for all of us who have been immobilized for months by a pandemic or just an outright act of self-torture. It's called Dirt. Adventures in Lyon as a chef in training, father and sleuth looking for the origins of French cooking. Bill, it's great to meet you. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, thank you very, very much for joining us, Bill. Love this. So just fill in some of the blanks. Dirt. Elaborate a little bit on what Jim said. What is it?
Dirt is the title, and it's the title because I kept looking for something that was describing what I was doing when I was in Lyon. And one thing I was doing was trying to get to the basics of French cooking, basic training so that I could be in a French kitchen. And something about that word basic took me to dirt. And the other thing I was doing is I was trying to get to the real taste of French cooking. They're like the goût, the thing that makes it different from other foods. And I kept coming back again and again to the roots, the plants, the unruined soil, the places where the cows graze to make alpine cheese, the dirt. And there is also, incidentally, I was in the kitchen and I did get, it has to be said, I got some dirt.
You know, yeah, I guess you did.
Before we spend time in Lyon, can we go back to New York for a second? Because I have some level of jealousy, and I'm sure a lot of people will be curious about this too. How does a guy with a great job, with a wife with a great job, with 2-3-year-old twins who are going to be denied the opportunity to go, what was it called, Jack and Jill preschool or whatever the hell it is,
exactly. Go to
Lyon and a place where no one knows who you are? What, can you describe the thought process that goes into that life-changing kind of thing?
And what those jobs were.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd kill for those jobs.
Yeah, I think, you know, some say ignorance is bliss. And I think in this case, ignorance turned out to be hell. And you're right. We had a pretty nice life. We actually had a very nice life. And we walked away from it. And we launched ourselves into a city that really doesn't like visitors, loathes tourists, is famously buttoned up and inhospitable. And we arrived in the middle of winter, just before Christmas, yanking the boys out of their preschool and yanking ourselves out of our lives to a place where I thought I would be known. I thought I could introduce myself as, you know, a staff writer at The New Yorker, a person who wrote this book about living in Italy and learning how to cook Italian, but they didn't care about Italian food and they didn't care about The New Yorker. They thought it was The New York Times and they didn't care about me. And it was less than easy. And it was very hard to get. My idea was that I would go over there and I'd work in a kitchen and I'd learn the skills in the job as I had done in my first book on cooking called Heat. And I couldn't get anybody to take me on. We got there, we got an apartment, we eventually got the boys in a French public school, we even got health care, and I couldn't get anyone to take me on.
I just want to elaborate on this for a second, because I've been in newspapers most of my life, or all my life, really. So your wife is at Harper's Bazaar, and you're a star at The New Yorker. I mean, that's kind of like the top of the heap. There you are, living the life in New York. So you were giving up a lot to go pursue the details and minutiae of French cooking. I mean, that your friends must have thought you were nuts.
My friends may actually think I'm nuts. My family do. There's quite a there's a pretty big team behind that idea that I don't really try to be nuts, but it's
okay.
But you know, The New Yorker. I mean, I was an editor. And I did become a staff writer, and the staff writing led to bigger and bigger pieces, and eventually it led to me wanting to go deep again. And being an editor is a great thing, and you make things happen, and you're in the thick of things, but it doesn't have the satisfactions of being a writer. And one of the great pleasures of being a writer is that you can, if you can make it work, you can kind of do the things that you wanted to do. And one of the things I always wanted to do was be a really accomplished cook. And I think I got pretty good at being an Italian cook, but everybody knows that, you know, if you want cooking chops, you learn them in the French kitchen. And you can't really do it by looking at Jacques Pepin videos, so they're really, really good. And you really can't do it by like reading, you know, Elizabeth David. I mean, although she's really, really good. you do it by going there. And what I learned was just enormous, enormous.
We're talking to Bill Buford. His latest book is Dirt. So there's a beautiful quote about Lyon. Calls it something like, I wrote it down, but I may not get exactly
about the
right.
Meal.
A place where what happens at the table is among the most important activities in civilization, intimacy, appetite, desire, euphoria, the joys of being alive. I mean, it made me really, want to drop everything and go to Lyon at least for the weekend. So elaborate on this place that you went to. Is that capture it?
Mealtime is a very big deal. Mealtime is the highlight of your day, and the better the meal, it becomes the highlight of your week and your month and your year and your life. I've never been in a place where eating was just so outright fabulous. It's not excess, although there were excesses. It's really the act of making food for people and bringing them to your table, and they're partaking in your food and what happens at the table. Lyon, there was a big thing like places, it's probably changed, but places would advertise whether they had continuous service. And continuous service, I thought, meant, oh, they're open all night or they're open on weekends and all the things you would expect from New York. Continuous service meant that they were open at lunchtime because everything closed at lunchtime and everybody had 2 hours at lunchtime. I used to cycle later, and I'd always choose to cycle at lunchtime because then the roads would be empty and you'd see sales reps in their cars. They would pull over and they would have a lunch, and you would go out to these restaurants, and there was the best bargain in the city. It was, for less than, 15, 20 euros, you would get a three-course meal with a glass of wine, and everybody took time out for lunch. It was built into the culture that the eating of food was a very serious piece of business. People didn't eat on the streets. I remember seeing a woman who got so hungry, she started eating something like a sandwich in the streets, and some man laughed at her, and she went into a corner of the building and then sort of ate it very privately. It's just not done. Mealtime is really kind of a there at that moment. It's a backward city. It's not like Paris. And it doesn't like tourists, so it's not really being spoiled by tourists, though it's starting to now. But it's a city that's got a kind of a sort of sacred commitment to the act of eating.
But talking to Bill Buford, the book is Dirt. When you say it's not Paris, I was in, remember 30 plus years ago, I was in Paris, and I asked for a cafe to go. And they looked at me like I had come from another planet. So it wasn't just Lyon where you don't eat on the street. So you describe some of the characters, some famous in the food world, some not so famous except locally, who you hooked up with and what that was like, Bill Buford.
Well, in the beginning, I tried to go to the temple of gastronomy, which is La Pyramide in Dien, which is 20 miles south of Lyon. That's famous for Fernand Point, but I got rejected there. I then tried to get into Mère Brasier, which is run by Mathieu Vianney. And Mère Brasier was one of the great legendary figures in Lyon, the first woman to get 3 Michelin stars and the first woman to have 2 establishments with 3 Michelin stars. So the first one to have 6, and she died, and then the business eventually closed, and it had just been reopened. I couldn't get in there. And I eventually went to the Institut Paul Bocuse and was always living in Paul Bocuse's shadow. And he was like, it was like being with God. And once I spent some time with God and got my education at school, I then got back and worked in Mère Brasier under Mathieu Vianney. And it started to open up Lyon. There was Bob, the baker. I worked with Bob.
Oh, tell us.
Restaurant
jump. And he was like this just big-hearted soul who was interested in making sure that everybody had bread and that it was good bread and that it was made with good flour and that it was nutritious. And he was he looked like Fred Flintstone and was flabby and didn't look after himself and got no sleep. But he was just one of the great pleasures of my life to work for him. I worked in some Bouchon. We kind of just made ourselves part of the city.
Through the years that Marty have been on the radio, we've spoken to either a lot of people who've written about food, a lot of chefs, a lot of restaurant tours. And when I'm, some of the scenes, particularly was Hortense, the name of the only woman who was in
Hortense,
when the pots are being flung at her. Is the sadism level higher in a French kitchen than it is in an American kitchen? Can you make that comparison?
Well, I thought here in New York City, and I worked at Babbo under Mario Batali, I thought I saw a kind of crude, brutal behavior that was unlike anything that I had known before and was so different from what you would see the moment you stepped out the door. But it was nothing. It was nothing compared to...
Meaning what? Meaning what, Bill Buford?
You know, I think part of it was the kitchen was under stress. It had just reopened. The funds were tight. It immediately got two Michelin stars. The whole world was watching. It was packed every night. And we had a small crew, and everybody was under pressure, and the hours were insane. We started at 8 in the morning. We finished at midnight, sometimes 1, sometimes 1:30. There was a little break. There was a pause in the afternoon. Some people skipped it because they were so busy. And by Wednesday and Thursday, the people in the kitchen were insane with exhaustion and really, really volatile. And there's a kind of there's just a nastiness in the kitchen, which seems to be what you have to get through. And if you get through it, then you're accepted. People were smashed up against the wall. There was one boy who got just teased mercilessly, and then at one point he became a teaser, and I really thought he was getting his face smashed in. Poor Hortense, she ended up working with a very talented chef whom I liked a lot, doing the starters and the grand manger in the kitchen. And there was an episode, and I don't know what provoked it. I was there in the kitchen at 8:30 in the morning, and she came running into the main kitchen while Sylvain came marching after her and then swept all the pans off the flat top, and they came crashing down. I thought something had exploded, and then picked them up one by one and threw them at her head. Bam, bam, bam. I've recently been in touch with her, and I wrote her, well, but I got to send her the book, I wrote her for that, but I wrote her to apologize that I hadn't intervened, and she confessed it was so much worse than it seemed. She just hated it. I think she got, you know, guys pretended to mount her. They were filthy with her. She was the only woman in the kitchen. It's changed. But at that moment, it was not a good moment. And I also have to admit, you know, when I was there, I was within 5 feet of her while the pans were being thrown at her head. And it puzzled me that afterwards that I didn't intervene, because at any other moment in life, I have generally been an intervener, and I didn't. And I wonder why.
Why? What is your answer to your own question, Bill Buford?
It might be I was just afraid. There was a certain ambiguity in my role, because I was a journalist there. I was a writer. But actually, at that point, I was no longer a writer. At that point, I was a member. I was a member of the kitchen, and I was expected to work the hours of the kitchen and make my contribution. And if I weren't there, the kitchen would be having a harder time. So, for purpose of my story, I was in the ideal place. But it did mean I didn't. I don't think I knew what to do. I regretted it.
Bill Buford. Go ahead.
Regretted not stepping in and protecting her.
Yeah. I was just going to say that there are so many people that talk about in the course of the Me Too movement and the things we learned about in the restaurant business and Hollywood and every place else. I think there's dozens of people who said exactly what you did, that they didn't intervene and they regret it now. And it was part of it, I think, was being a different time. But I also wonder about, we've talked about this with our food critic, Corby Kummer, who writes for The Atlantic and a lot of other places. He's talked about this enormous pressure. Yeah, he's a great guy. This enormous pressure surrounding these Michelin stars, and that things can really go way off the rails, and that restaurant owners themselves can fall apart under that pressure. Tell people, because that's part of what was going on there. Is that different in Europe than the United States, or is it the same?
I think there's a lot of pressure in the Michelin restaurants. And I don't, there are owners who can definitely sink and get depressed and lose their stars and kill themselves. That has happened.
It's happened
a couple times in memory. But this is more a case where there's a kind of Michelin star pressure, and the owner steps back and the chef steps back and they don't intervene. And as long as the meals are prepared correctly and punctually and well, then they're not going to intervene. And then there's just a wild thing that happens. It is a lot of pressure. And the pressure is, at least when I was there, it's just the hours. There was a scene I wrote about when, I have a hard time getting dressed and undressed quickly, and I'm always the last one in the kitchen. I'm always the last one to leave. But I made a point of trying to get out really, really, really quickly. And so I would stash my clothes in a corner in the pantry and rush up there so I'd be out of everyone's way. And I almost got out in time when everyone came rushing up the stairs in the dressing room, and I had my legs and my trousers, and I couldn't get my other leg down. And they all came up and they looked at my stomach and they said, "Ah, la planche de bille." And they started poking and going, "Wow, you've lost so much weight. Look at him." They all gather around. "Wow, look how much weight he lost. Look at him." They all touch me. And Sylvain says, "Ah, c'est cuisinier. You're a real cook." And that was just from the hours. I wasn't doing exercise. I was trying to eat as much as anyone else, but it's just like the hours. Just you're going up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down for 14, 15-hour days, and you lose this weight. But it does create – it was a really unusual environment. I have never been in a place like that. And I don't – it's not normal. I worked in a French restaurant under Michel Richard in Washington, D.C., and that was a lovely place. And it had a pretty good ratio of men to women. It was just about 50-50. The people were civil. They weren't berserk. They had the luxury of an American economy and lots of space and expensive prices they could charge for the dishes and things like that. But it doesn't have to be like that. And since then, there's been this real surge of women in the kitchen, and I'm full of admiration for them because they've all gone through this and they've come out the other side, and they're tough people and great, great cooks. Like on Sophie Pic in Valence, just south of Lyon. I mean, these are people who pay dues and they have their chops, and they're changing the kitchen, and it's only for the good.
How good a cook are you?
I can hold my own. I can work in a French kitchen, and I've done some cooking here with Daniel Boulou and the sort of the Lyonnais chef here in New York City, and he's got many other places. And we're going to be cooking together soon. I'm now doing starting up a column. It's been a little intermittent, but doing French preparations for The New Yorker online. I'm just going to be finishing one today on how to roast the perfect chicken. And my boys are making videos of it in which they completely kicked my butt. I did one on how to make an omelet and how not to ruin other sauce béarnaise. And I'll be doing some more on bread and the variations you can do with mayonnaise and trying to get the basics of the French preparations. I mean, I'm completely in it. You know, at one point, I had wanted to open a restaurant. But apart from the fact that, I'm getting on a bit and it's not really the time to start a restaurant, I think to be so exclusively in a thing like that would make me feel claustrophobic. So I kind of like the spot where I am right now.
By the way, the bar is very high. Jacques Pepin has told us about how to make the perfect chicken. So we'll judge you by comparison. Before you go, Bill, you're back. Here, obviously, and we talk almost every day about the sad restaurant scene. We're even with the preliminary reopening where you can serve people outside. So many restaurants say that's enough to survive. Some have already announced that they're closing. What's the landscape like in New York?
Less pretty than it is in Boston, and I can't believe it's very pretty in Boston. I think there in New York, there's a matrix of high real estate values, high rents, and restaurants that are having to pay those rents and have a high enough turnover to meet their costs. That's all going to collapse, I think. And I don't think we're going to know what it looks like for another year or two or three. But I do have hope in believing that there might be an attitude towards restaurants that I came to to see at work in Lyon. It was like, you know, the French are very famously skinny, but they're famously piggy when they go to restaurants. And that's because they're not piggy at home. At home, they often have a light supper. They have a souper. Mm-hmm. They have their big meals lunchtime. And they're actually very restrained eaters. But when they go to a restaurant, it's a big deal for everyone. They do not want small portions. They want every single course. They want all the extras. And they always, always, always eat dessert. There's a big convocation here in New York where there were French winemakers who came over, and the Americans were all blubbery and drunk, and they drank everything, and we had food. And then when the dessert came, they said, oh, no, I don't know. I don't need dessert. And the French, all these skinny French men and women, immediately sat down and ate their dessert. And behind that is a great honor bestowed on the idea of the restaurant. And I think I'd like to believe that as we get back, and we've been doing home cooking, and we've got sick of spaghetti, that we're going to have a new respect for what it is. Maybe restaurants will be more expensive, but we're not going to go out as much. We're not going to be ordering in as much. But when we go out to a restaurant, someone is making food for us. Someone's done the shopping. Someone's doing the cleaning up, and they're serving us. And it's such a privilege. And I think that sense of privilege we've lost in our spoiled have-it-all America. And that sense of privilege is what I enjoy the most in going out to restaurants in Lyon. Going out to a restaurant is a very, very big deal. Mm. And I think that's going to happen soon here.
Bill, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on the book.
Yeah, a pleasure to read your book and a great pleasure to talk to you, too. Thank you very much, Bill Buford. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill Buford's latest book is Dirt, Adventures in Lyon as a Chef in Training, Father, and Sleuth Looking for the Origins of French Cooking. Bill Buford, thank you again. And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Frontline correspondent Martin Smith, CNN's John King, and Trini Kuznarek. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Mers, Arjun Singh, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Uberly, and Aidan Conley. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Our offsite engineers are Miles Smith and Dave Goldstein. Jim Browdy, what's on TV?
Let me just say, when you say Martin Smith from Frontline, I watched last night the documentary. It's airing, I think, Tuesday night on coronavirus and how it happened.
Yes.
And it is spectacular. So you'll want to join us and you'll want to watch. Deval Patrick, former governor, is going to join me tonight. Two of the young people behind the black and brown youth-led movement here who've been demanding change at City Hall, they're going to join me. And as we discussed the other day, you weren't here, with Andy Anatko, about all these companies at least putting on hold their facial recognition. Christina Quinn takes us back to the beginning at MIT and about how the technology, put it mildly, is flawed. So that's all tonight at 7 o'clock on Greater Boston.
Well, I must say, since he's no longer a politician running for office, I can say when we had Deval Patrick on the radio,
it was so moving.
And I'm sure he'll be fantastic to listen to tonight.
I'm
Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a great afternoon.